All right, the committee will come to order. We actually do have a quorum. Representative Lane, will you move the minutes of the March 18th meeting and the March 19th meeting?
I move the minutes.
Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the minutes for March 18th and 19th, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. All right. Representative Lawford, you want to go? And just so folks know, if you happen to be waiting around or interested in House Bill 1803, Representative Scalzi's bill, we're not going to be hearing that bill. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'd like to move House File 1728 for passage and referral to the General Register.
I think it's going to go to Early Childhood Finance and Policy.
Oh, excuse me. Right. Forget we have one more stop. And I have an amendment that I would like to move, which is H1728A3, the technical amendment in the drafting and references.
Okay, all in favor of that amendment say aye. Aye. All opposed? And that amendment's adopted. Motion prevails.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, and would you want to take the other amendment? It's not mine, but it's a supportive piece as well.
Sure.
Representative Bruce, I believe.
Let me see that one. Day 2 amendment. Is that the one, Representative? Okay. Do you want to explain your amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes. This amendment encourages consolidation and coordination of services, and it allows counties to designate a home visiting nurse as the MSIP worker for a teen parent on MSIP as a parent exempted from work requirements because of an incapacitating illness. And I've spoken with the author, and she's okay with it, and we have been in discussions with DHS, and they are neutral on it as far as I understand. It's permissive, it's not a mandate.
And it doesn't cost any money either. Right. Okay, any discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of the amendment of the A2 amendment say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? That motion prevails. The amendment's adopted.
Thank you, members. This is the Department of Human Services bill that tries to do some administrative streamlining in the areas of child care, program integrity, adult supports, and MSIP. And like many of the Department of Human Services technical bills, it's had the input of lots of different people. I'm told it has been run past the counties, and they've agreed with the streamlining provisions included within this. But with that, I am going to, if you don't mind, turn it over to Ann Sessoms of the Department of Human Services to walk us through the exact provisions.
Okay, welcome to the committee. I think we can skip Article 1.
Yes.
Okay.
I'm Ann Sessoms from the Department of Human Services, and I'll start with Article 2, Program Integrity. There are three changes in this in this article of the bill. The first provision lists a ban on the state for charging counties for doing county-specific reports and other system changes. Right now, the department is prohibited from charging the counties, even if the counties want something that, this is not something that would affect a large number of counties, but for instance, if Hennepin County wants us to produce a certain report or make a piece of functionality available that only helps them or only helps a small number of people and they're willing to pay for it, right now we can't let them pay for it to get the work done. So this simply allows the department to be able to charge the county when they really want something done that would otherwise fall to the bottom of the priority list. The next two changes are relevant to the judgment by operation of law process. The first change is that we are specifically adding state-funded Minnesota care cases to the list of programs that can be handled through the judgment by operation of law. In addition, there's the clarification that for medical assistance, it's only the state-funded medical assistance cases that can be handled in this way. The third change has to do with streamlining the process for renewing these judgments, and it says that we can do that administratively without having to go back to the court. This is the way it's handled in child support now, and it would relieve counties of the burden of having to go back and into court in order to extend the judgment beyond the 10 years. The next article of the bill deals with general assistance and group residential housing clarifications. The first section simply updates the names of facilities because this hasn't been done for a significant number of years, and the classification of facilities is different than it used to be.
Representative Offer, just on that
Mr. Chairman.
Last one on the section 3, mm-hmm. just check with Representative Mallory, if you will. Okay.
The second section has to do with eliminating the need to relicense foster care when a child ages out of foster care at age 18 and wants to stay in the same facility. Right now, that facility has to turn around and become licensed as an adult facility. So this makes that possible. And
how would that work? The license would just continue?
The license would continue, okay. Right. And the third change has to do with updating statute to match the current location of a project that is in St. Cloud, but it is not in Stearns County. It is in Sherburne County. The next article of the bill is MFIT changes. And rather than go through them one by one, I wanted to lump them together because most of them are very technical. Section 1 increases the MFIT transitional standard based on the federal food support increases April 1st. So while the amounts are going up here, they are simply due to the changes in the federal food stamp program that are effective April 1st from the stimulus bill, and there isn't any cost to the state for doing this. Okay. Sections 2 through 6 and Section 9.
Can I just ask a question on that? Stimulus money, it's in the stimulus bill, but is this an ongoing...
Representative, sorry. The way that the food increase will work is the food always goes up and is adjusted October 1st of every year. And so the way the stimulus bill handled this is the allotments are going up April 1st. They will examine them again October 1st. And if it hasn't reached the threshold, they'll stay the same. And then next year, they'll examine them again October 1st. And there won't be a further increase in the program until it exceeds the amount that was put in there this year.
But it will never go down, and this is all federal money anyway.
This is federal money, and it won't go down.
Thanks.
Okay, sections 2 through 6 and 9 are technical fixes that align statutory language due to the implementation of the Family Stabilization Services. We're correcting references and we're removing unnecessary language based on changes that we've made over the past two sessions, and these are sort of final fixes, we hope final fixes that we found. Section 7 adds persons 60 years or older to family stabilization services. They were like the only group that didn't really fit there. There is no fiscal cost because there are so few of these people, but it seems silly to leave them in the diversionary work program for 4 months and not just move them to MFIP right away along with other people in family stabilization services. Section 8 adjusts the work participation rate target for counties by the federal caseload reduction credit. So Minnesota has to reach a 50% work participation rate target for the federal government. The state's rate is adjusted by something called the caseload reduction credit, and the counties came to the department and said, well, if the state's going to get credit for this, we want it recognized in our target because they also have a 50% target. And this was mutually agreed upon language where we could, it doesn't exactly align with the state because it happens after the fact, but it was mutually agreed upon that this is how we would recognize the credit for the county.
Is this related to stimulus bill?
No.
Oh, this is separate, okay.
This is separate. And finally, Section 10 eliminates the requirement that when counties refer a participant to the employment counselor for the diversionary work program, right now statute says the date, time, and location of the interview needs to be included in the information, and they don't always know that, and so we've removed that requirement from statute.
Didn't we try to do that last year?
I don't remember.
Okay.
Chair. I think we might have, and the bill might have fallen apart or something.
Oh, yeah. Okay. All right.
Never have.
Any other questions on the bill? Anything, Representative Loeffler?
No, Mr. Chairman. I'm just pleased that the department has worked with the counties, and they're streamlining some things.
Okay. All right. Seeing no further discussion, Representative Loeffler will renew her motion that House Bill 1728 be recommended to pass and referred to the Early Childhood Finance and Policy Division as amended. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you. Okay. Representative Clark, are you all ready? I just saw her. Okay. Then I'll go.
Representative Clark, were you? Did you?
No, you go.
Why don't you
take her?
Okay. You can. Madam Chair, welcome to the committee.
We don't have any good insurance.
Okay, Representative Clark, move that House file 264. Well, oh, you're not on the committee. The chair will move.
Yes, thank you.
We have not a time.
We don't have any of the material in our packet.
Okay. All right. So then, Representative Clark, since we don't have your material, we're going to go back to Representative Peace.
Okay. Madam Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 1322 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Civil Justice.
Okay, Representative Thiessen moves that House File 1322 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Civil Justice.
And I'd also like to move the DE2 amendment.
Okay, Representative Thiessen moves the DE2 amendment to get the bill in the order in which he would like to have it discussed. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
And then I do have an oral amendment, Madam Chair.
Okay. The amendment is adopted, and please state your oral amendment.
I'm page 7, line 12. Strike the words or general obligation. And on line 7. Oh, no, that's it. So strike the words on 7.12 or general obligation, because that's unconstitutional, apparently, to do.
Okay. All right. Representative Houston, if you would please repeat that. I didn't have a copy in front of me.
On line 7.12,
okay.
The end of the line strikes the word or general obligation.
Okay. Members, do you all have that? Okay. And we need to vote on that. All right. Well, let's vote on that. So the oral amendment on line 7.12, just striking with or general obligation. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Okay, the motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Okay.
Madam Chair.
Representative Peterson.
Well, this legislation is designed to put Minnesota in a position to draw down as much of the money in the federal stimulus package related to electronic health records. And so much of it is conforming our language in our statutes to what is the language in the federal law right now. And I'd like to have Mr. Golden come down and just to walk through it in a little bit more detail.
All right. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Jim Golden. I'm the director of the Division of Health Policy at the Department of Health. In just walking you through the amendment, subdivision 1 just requires that we actually report to the legislature on a regular basis on our activities related to standards. Subdivision 1A, it adds a definition section which really helps to make sure that the language that we're using in our statute just conforms and is consistent with the type of language that is being used in the stimulus package around health information technology. One of the things that we do is we actually just rename a committee, so that's actually the eHealth Advisory Committee as opposed to the name that it has, just for ease. It's consistent with the name that is being used. When you look at page 3 on line 15, one of the things that the legislature did in the 2007 session is pass a requirement that all healthcare providers use interoperable electronic health records by 2015. One of the questions has been, what does interoperable mean? Last year we said, well, it means a couple of things. It means that it needs to be certified by a national certifying organization. And we also said it needs to do e-prescribing according to certain standards. What we are doing in this section is just further refining that and being consistent with what's going on at the federal level. So they have actually, will be replacing the federal commission which does certification with a body that will be put into place by the Secretary of HHS. We tie ourselves to that. Where there was already a certification process to the degree that you needed previously to use a certified record, what we anticipate will happen now is there will be more certified records available. There will be certified records in more types of delivery settings. This just makes sure that we continue to use certified records. In those areas where there aren't certified records, there's going to be something called a qualified record. What a qualified record is a type of electronic health record which is in the queue to get certified. It meets certain functionality requirements like the ability to exchange information, store patient data, retrieve it at point of care, those types of things. And we just try to stay consistent with that. And finally, what we do is we also tie it to the definitions that will be used for the Medicare and Medicaid incentive payments to help providers get in line with their purchases to make sure that their purchases will be consistent with getting down the federal incentive money. What we have starting at line 4.1 is coordination with the national HIT activities. There are a variety of requirements that the federal government is required to do. So, for example, they are going to greatly expand their standard setting effort. What we have been doing and what we will want to continue to do at a much greater pace in Minnesota is to provide input into those standards when they're up for review. Because we have found that when we speak with one voice as a health industry from Minnesota, we get a lot more attention and a lot more opportunity to adjust those standards to be consistent with the way we deliver care and what our needs are. This is just really instructing the commissioners through our existing committees to continue that and to ramp that up based on the ramp-up work that will be happening at the federal level. One of the other big issues that we have for providers is there are two big issues, are capital and know-how. There will be a lot of activities at the federal level with an extension center, much like an ag extension center where there's going to be outreach, and there's also going to be regional ones. What this is requiring us to do is to make sure that we're having conversations with our regional extension center and that they're coordinated in with our overall work, so that they're not out giving one message and we're out trying to do something else as a health community. And this is really just keeping all of those pieces aligned. There are a variety of other things that we need to do. There are some grants that might be require a specific entity or a collaboration to be designated by the state. This clarifies that it's the Commissioner of Health that designates those entities and would designate them based on advice from the existing advisory committee, which has 26 public and private stakeholders on it, as well as consistency with the law that you have already passed, both on the clinical side as well as the administrative side. I think you'd be very interested in Subdivision 5, which starts on line 516. This deals with the collection of data for assessment. One of the things that is very true in the federal bill is when they're giving out $31 billion of money, every section has some type of criteria or report or other analysis to see that we're actually getting something for that money. And so one of the other things that the federal government is required to do is to pass some of those requirements to states and others for reporting requirements, so that at the end of 4 years, Congress and states can understand what did we get for the $31 billion that we put into health information technology. This really just allows us to collect data from healthcare providers, payers, pharmacy benefit managers, around how they're doing in health information technology, what types of functionality that they have. Things like on line 524, we need to look at their payer mix. That will be one of the requirements for the Medicaid incentives. So, for example, on Medicaid, you're going to be eligible for a share of incentive money based on the amount of Medicaid, SCHIP, and uninsured that you see. This just makes sure that we have the ability to collect that data and supply it as necessary for the grant.
And, Madam Chair, just two quick points on that.
Representative Thiessen.
The first thing is there's no personal medical data being collected here. This is all business data. I think that's important for people to understand. And really what this is doing is to try to, we're just matching up federal requirements with state requirements. So we're not adding new kind of data collection at the state level. This stuff people have to do to qualify for this money anyway.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Golden.
Madam Chair, and to that point, a couple of things that probably provide people some comfort. If you take a look at line 6.1, it actually, I guess, starts on 535. The Commissioner of Health is required to consider how it does any data collection, needs to use existing data where available, avoid any duplicative types of stuff, and try to maximize efficiencies. There's a variety of this data that might be already being collected either at health, human services, or revenue. To the degree we can, we will use existing data and not do anything additional. If you look at line 611, that's where we make very clear that there is no data that can be collected, published, or otherwise used that could potentially identify any individual patients. We don't anticipate any need to collect patient-level data for any of the reporting requirements that are in the stimulus package. So that concludes the first section of the bill. The first section of the bill is really about how we collectively work together using the $2 billion pot of money that I talked about previously in order to help the providers pull down their maximum portion. With the next section of the bill, Section 2 is really dealing with...
Let's just pause for a second and see if members have questions, first of all, on this section. Okay, I do have one question, and that is, I understand you're not really changing a lot here, but how does this treat the small provider, the person who may have trouble, you know, getting into the electronic world here?
Madam Chair, that's a very good question, and I think that you might find it slightly better answered in the next section. I think the next section is particularly well designed to help the small providers, particularly safety net providers.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead then.
Section 2 of the bill really deals with the second issue. So the first section was dealing with kind of the know-how, the technical side. The second is really on the capital side. As you'll probably recall, in the 2007 session, we put together a package of $14.5 million in grants and loans, and we developed a revolving loan fund for grants. One of the things that the federal stimulus package does is also put into place a loan program that's slightly more expanded and has some slight differences with the loan program that we had in the state. What we're doing with Section 2 is just changing our loan program in order to get the maximum amount of federal dollars into a loan program that can then be given to various types of providers. And as we go through it, I'll highlight how that focuses on particularly small and or safety net providers. So the first piece of the stuff, which is in 616 through about 631, just really ties to what the allowed functions of the loan activity is based on the federal law. What 632 does, this section starts to allow us to solicit private funds that can also be used to help supplement this. I don't know if that's going to be possible, but if it is, we will certainly try to do that. Line 7.8 through 7.14 allows us to use the loan fund to also do revenue bonds. It's not the Department of Health that would do the revenue bonds. We've had a number of conversations with DEED and Commissioner McElroy about some existing authority that they have for revenue bonds that would help 501c3s and critical access hospitals in particular. What the federal government allows is that these funds could also be used to help to do that. So what you would essentially do is use a small piece of the loan fund in order to get an enhanced pool of money that could then be available through a loan fund.
Okay, we have a question from Representative Lawson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Golden, I'm glad to see the use of revenue bonds. I actually had started to pursue that in 07 when we were doing this. But I'm a little confused as to what the status is of our current grant and loan program. Do we still have grants and loans state that were from the general fund, or have they all been obligated? And then I have a follow-up to that.
Mr. Golden.
Madam Chair, with regard to the grant funds, yes, those have all been distributed. Those were approximately $6.5 million in both Fiscal 7 and Fiscal 8. The distribution cycle on those is usually in October of the year, and then the grantees have 18 months to use those grant funds. So those have been depleted. With regard to the revolving loan fund, the base appropriation for that was $6.3 million over the biennium. It was $3.1 million in each of the two fiscal years. All of that money came from the Healthcare Access Fund. All of that money at this point is obligated in various loans to healthcare providers. Once those providers begin to pay back those loans, it will repopulate that particular revolving loan fund, either to give additional loans or for some other purpose. That's the only purpose in statute, but of course it could always be changed, I suppose.
Follow-up purpose as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the other question, it's sort of unusual for us to take public financing and then make public the identity of any private contributor to the loan fund, and yet it looks like they do get repaid ultimately, so it's really about a financial arrangement rather than a donation, as I'm understanding this, if that's correct. And how are you going to select, or what are the ethical limitations here? I don't see anything here that wouldn't say, you know, programmer AYZ with their latest electronic medical record product will, you know, fund this, and it looks like they're the endorsed state provider. So have you wrestled with those kind of issues yet?
Mr. Golden.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Loeffler, we would anticipate that those would be pretty restricted arrangements. Essentially, any private contributor, all they can do is put money into the loan fund and be recognized as putting it in. I suppose vendors or someone could do that. We were actually thinking perhaps more of foundations. And one of the things that the federal legislation specifically prohibits is that any funding that they would provide into the loan fund could be earmarked for any particular organization. And so what we would anticipate is that you might have some private foundations who would be interested in particular types of providers. So you might have a foundation that would like to contribute money to this to see that it goes toward primary care providers, or that it would go toward community clinics or some type of initiative like that. With regard to what the funds could be used for, we anticipate that the federal government would prohibit earmarking any type of product or vendor on this. Any product that is a certified electronic health record is qualified.
Representative Loeffler.
Madam Chair and Mr. Golden, I'm still a little confused because under 7.5, the commissioner may use the loan funds to reimburse private sector entities for any contribution made to the loan fund. So it doesn't sound like a foundation giving a grant to enlarge the pool. It sounds like it's actually a private sector financing arrangement, and so I'm a little confused with the discussion of a foundation because that would be different to me than someone who is helping us expand it through a bank or an investment company or something else.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, I think what the idea of this is when the federal government put it together and allowed this type of a transaction is I think that they think some states may have a problem finding financing in order to seed a loan fund. The loan fund actually has a 1-5 pull-down from the federal government, and that pull-down, the matching funds, have to be in cash. So I think the idea here was that there might be foundations that would be willing to seed a loan fund in order to pull down federal money. The loans would go out. At some point, the loans in our bill are 6 years. When those loans come back in, that particular contributor or foundation may want their funds back. You are correct. There is nothing here in this bill or in the federal legislation that restricts it to a foundation.
Representative Loeffler.
Madam Chair, Mr. Gold, just in conclusion, then I'd really like the author to think about as this moves forward a little more specificity here and dealing with conflicts of interest and some of those other issues that might arise with kind of the broad language. Having just presented a bill that had in statute what time and date an appointment would be for someone applying for a program, I think we don't have to get to that level of detail, but if we could at least just have a little bit more parameters, I'd be more comfortable.
Madam Chair, that
Representative Thiessen.
I'm very happy to do that.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Mr. Golden, you have more to...
I have just a little bit more to get through. On 7.15, it describes who's eligible. These are the eligibility categories that are under the federal bill. What you see, what we're doing in the eligible requirements in 7.15 through 7.28 is we're trying to make that pool as large as possible because we think that will help us to pull down the maximum amount of federal funds. Then in 7.29 through 7.35, we actually talk about prioritizing who the loan funds would first support. And this is really where we start to get to trying to prioritize on those safety nets or small providers who are most in need of capital to help finance their systems, critical access, FQHCs, community clinics, and primary care clinics.
Mr. Goldner, is your list there in order of priority? I mean, you've got them 1, 2, 3, 4. So is it your intention that's the priority, or is it a priority to all of these kinds of entities?
Madam Chair, it would be the priority to all of those entities.
Okay.
And we can clarify that, yeah.
Okay. Representative Abler has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Back to page 5, that question of data for assessment. I have a question, maybe I have an oral amendment just to clarify something there, but Mr. Golden, or Dr. Golden, that's just meant to be like test data, right? Just little samples of data to see how it's operating. Is that your intention?
Madam Chair, Representative Abler, this would not be any patient data. This would not be data that is related to the exchange of data or patient data or standards, it sounds like maybe what you're thinking. This is data that really looks to see, are we using electronic health records? So, for example, talking with providers about, do you have an electronic health record? What types of functionality do you have in your electronic health record? Can you do e-prescribing? Can you exchange a continuity of care record? The stuff that is in line 524 is specifically financial data that's required to determine eligibility for Medicare and Medicaid incentive payments, which would be your revenue mix or your patient volume mix. Mm-hmm. There's no patient data that's collected, test, or otherwise.
Representative
Abler.
My son has had a seizure, so I have to go deal with that. But and I guess I'll take it up later, but I'm just concerned that providers will be inconvenienced or unduly burdened with stuff that they have to do. The small providers are burdened by the stuff we've done in the past. There is trouble out in hinterland, and none of this is free for these small providers, so I'll see you later.
All right, and I've been asked to remind the committee that this is going to civil justice, and the reason for that is because they will deal with the data practices issues, so that will get another look.
And just to represent again, you know, the reason that people would do this is to pull down the money. And so if you don't want to pull down the money, presumably you wouldn't have to report necessarily on this stuff. Would that be fair?
On
many of these, yeah.
Okay.
Madam Chair, that'd be correct. On much of it, there'd be nothing to report.
Okay. All right. If there are no other questions right now, why don't we try to get through the rest?
Perfect. Madam Chair, I'm on page 8. These are pretty much making the loans align with the requirements of the federal law, talking that it's one of the requirements, for example, is that once you use a loan to buy certified technology, you have to have a plan to maintain it once that financing is over. And there are some other miscellaneous types of requirements that might be required as well. Within the loan, we changed just some of it to make sure that there's adequate funding available for the various providers. We have add the ability to have a low-interest loan that's below the market rate. That's, again, to distinguish between some of those who have priority status in there versus the other eligible criteria. Everything that is on page 9, 9-1 through 9-19, our requirements that the federal government has for being eligible for their portion of the loan money, we're just stating that our loan program has to make sure that we take that into account. 920 through 925 doesn't actually look like it's doing anything. I don't think any of that is new language. That's all existing language. I think that was just my mistake in helping to draft that.
Madam Chair, I'd like to delete
Representative
920 to 925.
Well, Representative Heaton, are you deleting it from current law?
No, just delete it from the bill. It's just sitting there with no changes in there.
Okay.
So I don't want to delete the language. I just want to delete the section.
Okay.
I'm not sure why.
I don't know if we need a... Yeah, if I could check with counsel here about that. It seems to me we wouldn't really need to do anything with it.
Madam Chair, because Section 2 of the bill is making changes to all of Section 62J.496.
Okay.
It's just in there with no changes.
All right.
Okay.
So forget it.
We'll leave it there, Representative Heaton. Okay. Please proceed.
Madam Chair, and then Section 3 is the same bill that Representative Huntley carried on behalf of the department that deals with the e-prescribing standards that bring us into line with the most current standards. And move us beyond just the Medicare standards that are there. And this is the bill that was heard previously in the committee.
Okay. Questions for members? All right. Seeing none, Representative Heaton, you want to say anything before we vote on the bill?
No.
Okay. Well, then Representative Heaton renews his motion that House Bill 1322 be recommended, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Civil Justice. All in favor, please say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
That's right.
The bill passed. Okay, Representative Clark.
Hey, Representative Clark, I will move that House File 264 be recommended pass and we were re-referred to Commerce and Labor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Bringing a bill before you that deals with the issue of asthma, which is, many of you know, probably all of you know, is a chronic respiratory disease, a very serious health issue for many of our Minnesotans. 1 in 14 Minnesota children and 1 in 13 Minnesota adults suffer from asthma. And for children, one of the important things to know about asthma is it's the number one cause of missing school. It's a very costly disease. And the premise of this bill is that we can reduce some of the costs by, in fact, dramatically reduce the cost by ensuring that our medical health plans, medical assistance, and dental assistance medical care, if they cover durable medical equipment, they must include the coverage of some low-cost items that will help reduce asthma symptoms, and these are items that are typically should be available in the home, and that includes air filters, certain kinds of vacuum cleaners that filter the air, bed pillows and encasements that protect the user from allergies, certain kind of filters on the gas furnaces and dehumidifiers. And this would apply, as I mentioned, to the health plans, to medical assistance, and to general assistance medical care. And in checking with 92, I was trying to make sure that it also covered Minnesota care, and it does, apparently.
Chair, just to clarify, Minnesota Care Covered Services, that section states that Minnesota Care covers MA services except as provided. So if nothing else is done, it should pick up this service. Although from a drafting standpoint, given that you have it in, you know, in MA, you could also put in Minnesota Care, but I don't think it's technically necessary.
So, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to call a couple of witnesses. We've been studying asthma, and the premise here, again, that some low-cost equipment that would be covered by our insurance, medical insurance, can really reduce our health care costs, again, particularly important to children, but important for all Minnesotans. And so there's a study that was done by the health department. So I'd like to ask to call Mr. Commissioner Adams to come and talk with us about that. I'd like to call someone, Advisor Shelf in Minneapolis as well, and also one of the people in our community who's dealing with this in her own family. So we'll start with Assistant Commissioner Patricia Adams. And Laura Oldman as well.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Pat Adams, Assistant Commissioner of the Community and Family Health Promotion Bureau at the Minnesota Department of Health, and with me is Laura Oldman, Research Scientist. We are just going to give you a very brief overview of a collaborative effort that has been addressing reducing environmental triggers of asthma. And this is really an excellent example of how we've been able to maximize a variety of funding sources to be able to address triggers for low-income children in terms of asthma events. The partners in this project were the American Lung Association of Minnesota through a CDC grant, the City of Minneapolis using a HUD grant, Healthy Homes grant, and the Minnesota Department of Health using a U.S. EPA grant. And these partners came together around targeting a common intervention using a common data collection tool to really impact the infected children. And so Laura Oldman will give you a very brief overview of the components as well as the targeted population and the outcomes of this project.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Our project, known as Reducing Environmental Triggers of Asthma, involved three components. Those components were an in-home education that looked at the proper medical management of...
And can you just say your name for the tape?
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay.
My name is Laura Oldman, and I'm with the Minnesota Department of Health and the Asthma Program. Again, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, our program looked at three components in the project. One was an in-home environmental or in-home education looking at the proper medical management of asthma and also looking at environmental triggers of asthma. The second component was an assessment of the home for environmental triggers of asthma. And the third component was providing the family with low-cost, what we call product interventions, that were tailored to the child with asthma, to their particular asthma triggers, and also to the household needs. In our project, we enrolled 54 low-income children. They all had poorly controlled asthma, and they were referred to our program through a physician. All of our children were recruited or brought into our program from the Twin Cities metropolitan area. Our most common product interventions, or what is listed in the bill as durable medical equipment, were the high-efficiency particulate air cleaners, bed and pillow encasements, which enclose those items particularly for dust mites, and the high-efficiency particulate air vacuum cleaners. The average cost of our initial home visit and products was $468, but products only were just over $200. Now, these are 2004 to 2006 costs. After we enrolled the families and did an initial interview, we followed up with the families at 3, 6, 9, and 12 months. And at the 12-month period post the intervention, we saw some real improvements in healthcare use and quality of life. Those included hospital visits declined by an average of one visit over a 3-month period. Unscheduled office visits declined by two. We saw improvements in things known as the daytime symptoms for asthma. That would include things like the child not complaining about shortness of breath. Nighttime symptoms, in other words, the child being able to sleep through the night. And also what we call functional limitations. An example is the child not having their activities, such as physical activities, exercise, limited by the asthma. One of the most noticeable improvements were in missed school days, where we saw over a 3-month period the children had an average of 7 missed school days, and that declined down to less than 1 12 months later. The cost saved by the home visit and product interventions amounted to about $1,900 per child on average. Thank you.
Are there any questions to the witness members? Representative Brock.
Thank you very much. And the children were referred and the families were referred. Were they then, they had to volunteer to be part of this study? Is that my understanding?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is correct. They were asked if they wanted to participate in it, and they also signed a disclosure form agreeing to participate in the project.
Okay. And Mr. Chairman,
Representative Brown.
I just had a question related, so I appreciate the information. This is your information, please.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe that's from our next speaker with the City of Minneapolis, but there's a lot of similarity.
Okay, all right. Well, the content is, I guess, maybe what I'll focus on are two things of the four that they indicate in this letter are smoking, dust mites, ventilation, and pets. And it's hard to deal with two out of those four, and I know that this bill deals with the two in the middle. How do you, in your efforts, deal with the issues of the smoking issues and then the pet issues in these homes that the folks volunteered to participate?
Mr. Chair, Representative, one of the activities that would be involved that we did during the home visit and we would do later on is smoking cessation. There is a program now where when we go into the home, we would ask if the family member who smokes is interested in enrolling in a priority sex smoking cessation program. If they say yes, they would be contacted within, I think it's 3 working days, about getting them enrolled in a smoking cessation program. So that's already a project that exists. The other one was pets. And we do have another witness that I think might be able to speak more directly to that. But again, it's an educational effort where we talk about the pets, and if they are unwilling or unable to find another home for the pet, we talk about cleaning and other techniques that might reduce the child's exposure to those allergens.
And the study was related to kids.
Mr. Chairman, yes, our study was just children ages 0 to 18.
Okay. Representative Ember.
Still. Mr. Chair, it maybe one of the witnesses here, can somebody direct me, is there a statutory definition for durable medical equipment?
Mr. Chun or one of the witnesses? Is there a definition? The definition of durable medical equipment here.
I believe it's in federal law.
Do we have any? Do we know what it means, or is it pretty broad? We don't know. Okay. Okay. Thank you. Any other questions for the witness? Representative Brown.
Actually, I just had a question for Representative Clark, because I actually know Representative Emmer pointed out something to me.
the way I read 1.13 is that if you have a health plan then that doesn't cover durable medical equipment, then you're exempted out of this requirement. Is that correct?
That's the way this is written at this point. That's right.
Okay.
And Mr. Chairman, I might point out, I think on, I'd like to suggest an oral amendment when we're done with the witnesses. It's very, just one word amendment that might make a little clarity for some of that.
Okay.
I like
and we do need to move Eliza relatively
Bell.
Quickly through
okay,
this.
Okay, Eliza Bell, and then maybe I'll read my thing as lunch comes in the appeals table.
And the reason I say is we have to get through three bills so we can get them processed and up to the floor for tomorrow. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Eliza Sell, and I work with, this is Kate Kofal, and I work with the City of Minneapolis as the Healthy Homes HUD Grant Manager. Kate Kofal is Managing Director of In-Home Asthma Management from Pediatric Home Service. We are in our sixth year of a demonstration project that is funded or has been funded in part by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, who supports the reduction of asthma incidence in children. In 2003, we began completing home environmental asthma assessments with three objectives. The three objectives were to empower and educate children with asthma and their families, to conduct an in-home environmental assessment to identify asthma triggers, and also to create individualized environmental asthma action plans focused on trigger reduction. The three-pronged approach was published by the American Public Health Association as the Minnesota model and was developed by partners at the Minnesota Department of Health, City of Minneapolis, St. Paul Ramsey County Department of Public Health, Pediatric Home Service, Hennepin County, and the American Lung Association. The asthma home assessment team is comprised of a certified asthma educator and the Healthy Homes building specialist or a housing authority or code official. To date, since 2003, we've completed over 1,100 assessments in the home and interventions for children with asthma. These results have shown statistically significant reductions in emergency room visits, hospitalizations, missed school days, oral prednisone use, and the children showed improvements in daytime and nighttime symptoms and functional limitations. We had many partners, including Children's Respiratory and Critical Care Specialists, Children's Hospitals and Clinics, Minnesota, Hennepin County Medical Center, local area clinics, and Minneapolis and St. Paul Public Schools. In summary, I guess, we do support the House Bill 264 in making the medical equipment necessary for asthma management and environmental the allergen reduction in the home. We, in each one of our 1,100 and so interventions, the children did receive air cleaners, which we found were instrumental in reducing the dust burden in their home in their bedroom, especially where they spend at least 8 hours a day. And we also support furnace filters, allergen vacuums, bedding encasements, dehumidifiers, etc. We also urge that if these tools be made available on a widespread basis, that they be delivered by certified asthma educators so that they can work holistically with the families and talk about the triggers, the medications, certainly things that could exacerbate asthma in the home, and also try to bridge the families and the doctors and the clinics and the asthma educators to the local housing authorities so that they can also work on the buildings and the structures and especially in rental properties, which is where we're seeing our greatest incidence of asthma exacerbation in the cities.
Is where, say that one more time, you've seen the greatest
in exacerbation, I guess, the worsening, the greatest number of our children that...
Where was that?
In rental properties.
Rental properties, okay. I'm sorry, I just missed that piece. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, my name is Valerie Martinez. I am a single parent of an 8-year-old child with asthma. I live in the Phillips community, and I am one of the cases don't have smoking in my house, and I don't have any pets. However, I live in a neighborhood that's surrounded in a fifth place, and there's parks that are surrounded by three highways, so a lot of the toxins that they breathe in are from the highways and from the air, And so, his asthma tends to be treated a lot more. However, I do work full-time. I have three kids. I am on a fixed income, so a lot of these equipments that would be eligible for medical or care would make it a lot easier for me to maintain and stabilize myself asthma due to the prices and being a low-income household. So I would just encourage and just say thank you for listening for us today, but this is very needed.
Thank you for coming. And I had two questions, one for each of the witnesses. The first one, on the study, and you made a little bit of mention of the fact that as the products are delivered, that they be accompanied with education. How significant is that education piece to the success of the pilot project that you did, as opposed to just the delivery of the equipment?
My name is Kate Kufall, and I'm a certified asthma educator, and I did do the delivery on all of the products involved in all of these grants. And our education is to go in to explain all the products, how do they use them, how do they maintain them. To just about a vacuum cleaner probably wouldn't get the use that it needs to be. How to change the bags. You would be surprised at the number of people that do not know how to do basic home cleaning.
I may not be surprised at that.
We want these products to last more than just a couple months, and so we have to teach people what to do.
Yeah. Okay.
We also are touching bases on all of their asthma at the same time. And have we made any significant changes? How else can we help them? It's turned out to be a referral into many, many other areas as well.
Yeah, and the reason I ask is because the bill doesn't get at that piece of the puzzle. And just if you feel comfortable, and I'm sorry, Ms. Martinez, is that
yes.
Right? Do you have insurance through work?
No, I don't have insurance through work. We are a nonprofit organization that doesn't offer insurance at this moment.
Okay. Representative Liebling had a question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And, I have some concerns with it. I mean, I really understand the issue about asthma, and I think it's, an incredible burden on children. But as Representative Thiessen said, the bill doesn't say anything about the education. The bill itself is just an insurance mandate, as I see it. And, we know this is going to go to a finance committee. Obviously, it costs money in the state budget, but I just have trouble with this because it also doesn't distinguish between, for example, homes where there is smoking. And I don't know how say you've got a home where the parents are smoking in the home and the child has asthma. The first thing that you would do, I would think, maybe I'm wrong about this, but is try to eliminate the smoking, which we did talk about before. But until you did that, to have an insurance mandate that says, well, now, we've got to go to these other things and make somebody pay for them. I guess I'm just kind of wrestling with the mandate part of it because, not that I, have a great love for insurance companies, but I do think that, costs are passed on to others who are paying the premiums. And I don't know, could you just address that a little bit? I mean, the mandate part of it, I get the health part of it. Truly, I do. I mean, I'm a single payer advocate. I think we should be taking care of everybody much better than we are, but I'm not really sure that this is the way to do it.
Mr. Chairman, well, I don't know if you heard the part about how this actually saves you money and saves the state money. For an investment of a couple hundred dollars in durable medical equipment that's listed here, and we actually went online to look at some of the costs. It varies, but the study that they did was about $200. The actual cost to have I believe it's one
hospital visit and two office follow-ups, which is sometimes how people get into this trouble with not having any treatment for asthma, is more than $2,500. It's about $2,500. So if you're concerned about the state budget and you're concerned about passing on costs, this is passing on cost savings to do this. Now, the part about the educational aspect, I would really have liked to include that in the bill, but I did want to add one word that I think might give a little bit of comfort, because it makes it clear that there would be others involved, and you know, there would be some judgment in deciding whether or not there should be a description, you might say, for this equipment, and that is on line 1.14 and in one of the places in the bill, I'd like to insert the word medically before the word necessary. So basically what we're saying is this would include coverage of the following items if medically necessary. And that would just be an oral amendment, Mr. Chair, on page line 1.14 on the first page, and the same thing on page 2 on lines 2.12 before the word necessary, and those lines would include
medically. I'll make that motion. Any discussion on that? Seeing none, all in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
Mr. Chairman, one of the reasons for that is that I do think it does require then some judgment, that there's a conversation that happens with the medical provider, with the health care provider, to determine is this medically necessary. In cases where it wouldn't be, it would not be, you know, authorized.
Okay. And Representative Clark, I think that there's actually an important piece here, and I'm glad we have this the study that was done, and I think it would be great if we could actually kind of fit that education piece in here somehow before we get to Representative Huntley's committee or wherever this, I guess not Representative Huntley's committee because it's Medicaid. But I, too, am concerned on the mandate. I'd like to see if we can do it in our public program first and see what cost savings we get. So I'm actually going to move an amendment to do two things. One is to focus it on kids, because that seems to be where the work has been done. And then to keep it in our public program. So what I'd like to offer is an amendment on page 1 to delete section 1. On page 2 at line 8, after B, insert for individuals under age 21. And then on page 3, on page 2 to delete section 3, because GAMC is all adults. There's no kids in GAMC. And so basically we would be left with section 2 focused on kids under line 21. And I'd actually like to continue to work then to see if we can get that educational component built into it as well, because I think that there actually is something to be done here, and I'd love to see a fiscal note. I don't think we get the fiscal note you want without incorporating that educational piece where we could actually save some money here. But we may be able to otherwise, and that would be good. So that's my motion.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask
Representative Clark, yeah.
I'm wondering if you wanted to actually delete all of Section 1, because my understanding is that is how we cover Minnesota care, and if we want to make sure we're having our public covered programs funded, we need to have Section 1, unless we have a separate section that covers Minnesota care.
Mr. Chen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, the Minnesota Care Law has a cross-reference to medical assistance and picks up the medical assistance coverage unless otherwise specified.
Okay. So Section 2 would pick that up.
Medically covering Minnesota.
Yeah.
Care. All right.
So, any discussion to that amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? And I also think that changes our motion as well. You don't have, I think you go right to finance at this point. Mm. But, okay, any further discussion on the bill? Do you guys want to testify on it, even though it's just medical assistance now? Okay, come on down. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. And I will be brief, and the amendments that were made certainly take away a lot of the concerns that we have with the legislation. This obviously would have a fiscal note tied to it, as been discussed. One of the things that I would still identify...
You better identify.
I'm sorry, Jeanette Coleman with Medica, representing the Council of Health Plans. You wanted me to be quick, so I...
No, I'm sorry.
I apologize. But, you know, we do certainly have some concerns still with the bill, and I think part of the concern becomes what is the role of different organizations and entities and agencies in this state. And so by requiring that this is something that would be covered under MA, you know, part of the problem is there's things like HEPA cleaners, HEPA vacuum cleaners. The costs of these are quite consistent, and there's nothing in here that ensures that these will be used. And so there's nothing really that shows. I have a vacuum cleaner. I don't use it as often as my husband would appreciate, but he does more often. But the other concern that we have is that on line 2.8, when we're talking about medical systems coverage of durable medical equipment, includes but is not limited to. So I have no idea where else that could go, but that's pretty broad as well. And the other thing that I would like to point out with this is, you know, this committee did a lot of work last year to look at healthcare reform and look at ways. Pediatric asthma is something we need to do a better job of managing. A child should never end up in the emergency room with an acute episode of asthma. Something went wrong in the system. And so we've done a lot of things. We've looked at creating healthcare homes that will do a better job of coordinating that. To the education piece, Mr. Chair, you know, I think one of the things that health plans have realized over the years is that we have been a big thorn in the healthcare system not working well because of how we pay for care. And we've got to change how we pay for care, and we've got to start paying for care coordination. We've got to start helping providers do things other than just the tyranny of the office visit. Being paid to do education on things like this is a piece of that. Also, this committee passed out legislation that passed last year in healthcare reform to create these baskets of care. Pediatric asthma is one of the things that has been chosen to pursue, and that we will be doing more work on that. So I completely support the efforts here. We need to do a better job of managing these things. I just don't know that this approach would add cost. It's not clear that this is the best approach to address this idea. So thank you. Thanks for the opportunity.
Representative Clark. Did you?
Do you want me to respond to that?
Yes, if you want.
Okay.
I thought you indicated
I
you wanted
understand
to.
Okay. I hope the point is that we are saving money, and we are saving children's lives, and we are reducing school absenteeism, which is very costly. You know, I just was approached by the witness a few minutes ago to indicate that there was a problem. So I guess I'll stand on the strong evidence that we have a very serious problem with childhood asthma. And it's actually, I didn't go into this, but I could do it. You know, if you want me to present evidence about the disproportionate impact of asthma on low-income people and people of color, I'd be glad to do it. I have a map to do it for you. It's one of the reasons actually Representative Huntley urged me this year to do something to help deal with the fact that this is a huge health disparity. And it's very related to the to the problem of absenteeism in school. Again, asthma is the number one cause of school absenteeism in this state. And it's serious. And I think to do nothing, to wait around for, you know, I'm not sure what the witness actually was suggesting we wait for, but I really hope that instead we will go forward with this. I like the chairman's idea that we add some educational component. I think that's good. I'd be glad to work with you on however you think would be appropriate to do that between now and the next next committee.
And Representative
Dowell. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Clark, I have two asthmatics in my family and in my household, and we've tried a lot of these same things. And I guess my concern is, yes, asthma is a very serious issue, but we do need to address it. Is this the right way to address it is my question. And these devices, these mechanisms, can be helpful if used absolutely 100% perfectly in a perfect environment. But there is questionable scientific research about how it generally helps reduce allergens. Some of them can do a fair job of it. Some of them, if not used properly, can have very little impact. And we've experienced all of the above in our family. So I salute the effort in the area of asthma, but I question the mechanism. The HEPA air cleaners alone are incredibly expensive. HEPA vacuum cleaners, depending on which one you buy, can be extremely expensive. And if not utilized and maintained properly, can have very little effect. Allergy bed and pillow encasements are fine until they have a break in them, or if they're not applied properly. Even filters for gas furnaces can be installed improperly and not have the kind of effect you hope they have. So I guess I'm concerned about how this bill approaches it, although I do recognize and personally live through the need to address asthma.
Any further discussion, Representative Brown?
Mr. Chairman, I was just trying to grab the statute book because I seem to recall a discussion we've had over the last number of years, and I don't have the answer yet. So hopefully as it goes forward, we can get the answer. But, you know, we have this discussion of mandates, and each mandate individually comes from a good story and oftentimes has a good rationale behind it. But as you stack them up, you start pushing people off the affordability scale. And I know this is, you just kind of pulled it into the public programs, and I can appreciate and understand that, but it's still, what I'm trying to find out is whether the public programs, if a mandate on public programs goes through the mandate process that we have related to 62J, that's the answer that I'm going to be looking up in the statute, but I did just want to put on the record that we do have a process to assess mandates, yet every year we have a number of bills that sidestep that process, and if we're going to continue sidestepping the process, maybe we ought to either reform or get the process out of law, because it's not actually working the way it probably ought to. And I think part of the process, the intent of the process, was to make sure that legislators are making the decisions based on cost-benefit analysis that is done by somebody other than the advocates bringing it forward. And other than, you know, we want to respond to our constituents, and we want to respond in a positive way to the needs that are out there, but there is a bigger picture, and that's what 62J is intended, I believe. So I'll be looking, Mr. Chairman, to see if it addresses public programs. I don't know, but I did just want to put on the record that I think that's an issue that we should be talking about.
Well, I think you'll find some sympathy on other members of this committee to look at that. I think looking at Mr. Gross, that 62J doesn't necessarily cover public programs. It's just on the private insurance market. Any further discussion on this bill? Okay, seeing none, I will renew my motion that I'll actually amend my motion that House File 264 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance as amended. All those in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. We have to get through two more bills here so we can get a process for tomorrow before we break. And that's Representative Hosh. Are you here? Yes, you are here. 1709. I'll move that House File 1709 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Civil Justice. Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1709 is a bill from the Department of Human Services dealing with child welfare policy, and is mainly a technical bill that addresses or corrects some cross-references, strikes redundant languages, complies with some of the federal regulations with the Fostering Connections to Success of the Increasing Adoptions Act of 2008. Since this is a very technical bill and there are others that are much more informed on this issue than I will turn it over to the department to discuss the details of the multiple sections throughout House File 1709.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Christine Borsheim from the Minnesota Department of Human Services, Division of Child Safety and Permanency. As Representative Haas just indicated, this is kind of the two articles in this bill, the first being largely technical. Most of the technical language is around amending the Interstate Compact for the placement of children to be consistent with the standards that are being adopted nationwide. That actually makes up most of the technical changes. The rest of them are about changing definitions, a reference in Chapter 260C to reference voluntary placements for children for treatment. Sections 4 and 5 related to background studies are amended to maintain continuity of the county and commissioner's responsibilities throughout the section of the statute. This is in relation to emergency relative placements primarily. Other technical amendments are to correct the site reference, construction of a sentence, a statement of revisers instructions. The remainder of the bill, Article 2, is the child welfare policy pieces. These policy changes are primarily offered to strengthen the state's performance on key federal performance measures, to improve outcomes for children and families who are served by the child welfare system, and to implement provisions of the Fostering Connections to Success and Increasing Adoptions Act of 2008. These policy changes do affect Indian child welfare, child protection, and foster care services. Section 1 of Article 2 is actually one of the sections that brings us into compliance with federal requirements. This section adds a provision in data privacy statutes that allows child support to share data with child welfare for the purpose of establishing parentage and locating parents. This supports achieving permanency for foster children and is consistent with changes in federal laws. Section 2 allows tribes participating in the Indian Child Welfare Initiative, which is the Leech, Lake, and White Earth tribes, to conduct children's mental health screenings and to establish local child mortality review panels comparable to the practice in the county agencies. Tribes are to provide written notice to the commissioner and affected counties when the child mortality review panel is established. Section 3 contains an amendment to clarify that the requirement to search the Minnesota Father's Adoption Registry does not apply when the agency is proceeding under the Safe Place for Newborn section. Section 4 makes a limitation on asserting an interest in a child when a putative father does not register with the Father's Adoption Registry applicable in both adoption and termination of parental rights proceedings. Currently, that's just applicable in adoption proceedings. Section 5 helps us come into consistency with federal requirements in part. This section pertains to amending the reasonable effort standard social services agencies make to prevent placement and finalize a permanent plan for a child. The amendment clearly identifies a safety plan as an effort to prevent placement. It also clarifies that reasonable effort standard to prevent placement does not apply when community services cannot meet a child with disabilities needs for treatment. It also clarifies that those placements must be determined to be medically necessary. When placement is necessary, this section clarifies that the child's relatives are to be contacted and provided notice, and identifies efforts to place siblings together or ensure sibling visitation. Section 6, 8, 9, and 21 are related to foster care. These sections align the definition of foster care in Chapter 260B, which are the delinquency statutes, with the definition of foster care in Chapter 260C, the child protection statutes. These sections ensure that foster care is intended to provide for a child's safety, the safety of others, or to access treatment. It clarifies that foster care must not be used as a punishment or consequence for the child's behavior. Section 7 amends the considerations of the juvenile treatment screening teams to consider the availability of community services when determining if out-of-home placement is necessary for a child with disabilities. Sections 10 and 11 clarify the definition of a parent, and they add provisions to the statute to ensure diligent efforts to identify, locate, and notify both parents of a child. This includes the use of genetic testing. It also lists what types of efforts the agency must make to find parents and defines court procedures to review those efforts. It also specifies that these efforts do not apply to safe place for newborn situations. Sections 12, 13, 14, and 15 provide procedures to issue a notice or summons when filing a petition for termination of parental rights. It ensures that a summons is issued to a parent and a notice is issued to a grandparent with the right to participate. It defines written notice and makes clear that it is not a requirement to notify a putative father who has not registered with the Father's Adoption Registry. Sections 16 and 30 provide the juvenile court with authority to use alternative dispute processes such as family group decision making, parallel protection process, or mediation to resolve child welfare matters as appropriate and in the best interest of the child. Sections 17 and 18 concern police officers taking a child into immediate custody under a 72-hour police hold. When a child runs away from a parent or guardian, the statute is amended to order that the police officer may transport the child home to a relative or to another safe place, and it eliminates running away as a reason for taking a child into custody. When a child is taken into custody for any reason, the statute is amended to provide social service agencies with the authority to release a child from custody after an assessment and implementation of a safety plan for the child. Section 19 also is also amended to remove running away as a reason to maintain a child in custody and adds reasonable effort standards to place siblings together and develop a plan for sibling visitation. Sections 20 and 22 ensure that the responsible social service agency has a duty to develop and implement a plan for parent visitation and contact unless the court finds that a visitation would endanger the child. It sets uniform procedures to address visitation for a parent who has had no or limited contact with a child, and it allows parentage to be established for a putative father before visitation begins, if that is in the child's best interest. Section 21 specifies that if the court finds that a child is in need of protection or services because the child is a runaway or a habitual truant, the child may not be placed in foster care as punishment. The remainder of the sections are largely intended to bring us into alignment with the federal requirements. Section 23 amends the required content in out-of-home placement plans. It requires a description of specific efforts to ensure the child's health care needs are met, a plan to ensure educational stability, and how the child's health, mental health, and dental care records are going to be maintained while the child's in foster care. Section 24 applies the reasonable effort standards to placing siblings together in foster care and requires the agency to provide frequent visits in this if the siblings cannot be placed together. When joint placement of siblings would be contrary to the safety or well-being of any of the siblings, it requires documentation. Section 25 requires that monthly caseworker visits with children in foster care includes determinations of whether the child is enrolled in and attending school and addressing these issues through case planning and service delivery. Section 26 pertains to relative search, requiring due diligence to identify and notify adult relatives of the child prior to placement or within 30 days after the child is removed from the parent's care. It amends the notice requirement by adding that the relative may participate in the care and planning for the child. It also includes specific information about how the family foster care licensing requirements, about those requirements, and how to request a variance from those standards that do not present a safety risk to the child. It actually facilitates more placements with relatives. Section 27 pertains to foster youth age 17 or older in foster care who are aging out. There is now a requirement for the agency to develop a transition plan during the 90 days immediately prior to the youth's discharge. The plan must specify options for the youth regarding housing, health insurance, education, employment services, and support services. And sections 28 and 29 are related to children in voluntary foster care for treatment. It clarifies that this child's treatment must be determined to be medically necessary.
Nicely done. Any questions? Okay. Seeing that Representative Hosh renews his motion that House File 1709 be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Civil Justice.
Mr. Chair, I don't think I can make that motion.
I make it. Thank you. Good point. I'll make that motion. All in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Thank you. Okay.
All right, we're on House File 1889, and Representative Peterson moves that House File 1889 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations, Reform, Technology, and Elections.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We have a program in the state that we have in law right now that set up a long-term care product, program that state employees can buy into. And this would allow local government employees to buy into that same long-term care insurance product. It's a little different from health care because the person pays the full cost of it. So there's no state subsidy going into this program. And this is coming out of Anoka County, so if the witness would like to testify briefly about it.
All right, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Lona Schreiber. I'm the Intergovernmental Coordinator for Anoka County.
And this issue was brought to us a couple years ago by our human resource director, and it's been in our legislative packet for a number of years. It is also in the packet of MICA, which represents the 13 larger counties as well. And it would be a purely voluntary thing. There's no cost to the state or to the local units of government, but our HR director thought that the pool is larger for state employees, so that there'd be economies of scale. And so the premiums hopefully would be a little lower, because some of those smaller local units of government just couldn't negotiate with enough premiums. And so if we had this option, and it would be purely voluntary, we just thought it would be a good thing. Purchasing long-term care insurance is a good goal, I would think. So it's that simple, Madam Chair, members.
Okay, questions for members? Okay, I guess I have a question. Does this, I see that this is permissive, not mandatory, but does it in any way obligate the local governments themselves to do anything in terms of making the offer to their employees? And I'm sorry, I didn't quite catch the witness's name.
Excuse me, my name again.
What's your name?
Lona Schreiber.
Schreiber, thank you.
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Mr. Chair.
Schreiber.
The former member of our house.
Yes.
Long time ago.
It would not, the intent is that it would not require, it would be optional both to the employee and to the employer to offer this program. And so they could make, basically the idea would be to make that the local government could say an option you can pursue is to buy insurance through this pool if you so choose.
Okay, and then is there, what about in terms of administratively, how would this work? Do they buy it through the state website, or, you know, what would be involved there?
Madam Chair, I think that they would be able to buy it similarly to how we do it. We would, as state employees, we have the option to do it or not on our own individual initiative. And I don't know exactly what that process is because I have not done it, but I would imagine it's the same. It would just be the same process as that would be, but we can clarify that.
Okay. Well, that would be good. I mean, I do buy it, Representative Chief,
okay.
And I think I buy it through through our payroll. It's the payroll deduction, so
okay.
We do it through our house payroll folks, and so that makes me wonder, you know, what the process would be. Okay. Other questions from members?
We may have an answer.
Oh, okay. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Keith Carlson, Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association, or MICA. All this does is really allow our employees to participate in the state rather than frequently the more costly local program if it is offered. And this would be no different than our employees' already participation or optional participation in the health care savings plan through the Minnesota State Retirement System. Local government employees can participate in it. It's a fairly seamless operation. We as an employer notify that MSRS, that employees are eligible to participate, or that employees are participating, and then we do payroll deductions under whatever scheme. Same thing also exists with regards to deferred compensation, so this would not be any significant administrative burden. It already exists in those other two examples.
Okay, so Mr. Carlson, the bill covers townships, municipalities. I mean, say you're a really small township. Is this going to mean that your employees are going to be able to come to you and say, you know, you have to make it possible for us to do this? Or, I mean, that's what I'm a little worried about. I mean, counties are one thing, but some of the smaller governments, you know, just what exactly is involved in offering this to their employees?
Madam, go ahead. You go ahead. And
okay, Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair, members, this is a collectively bargained benefit or benefit for those employees who do not have an exclusive representative, and a benefit that is determined by the personnel rules by the employer. So basically, it is something that the employer has to agree to, either through the collective bargaining process or setting up its personnel rules. If they choose not to do it because of issues that you've identified, if they have not collectively bargained, they don't have to. So for the smaller employers where that may be an issue, there's likely no collective bargaining. It's possible to opt out, but again, this is a pretty seamless operation. Our organization is a small employer. We only have two employees. We participate in the health care savings plan. We participate in the deferred compensation plan. It's no significant administrative burden whatsoever.
Okay, other questions for members? Okay, we've got somebody. Oh, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know if this is to Representative Thiessen or the others, but I seem to recall that the state employee plan actually allowed people to cover family members, even parents and siblings. And I'm just wondering if you've had any discussion with Dura about whether or not they need to do some actuarial analysis of how the group might change. I don't know.
Madam Chair.
Representative Thiessen.
The buying in would be identical to what the state plan is. I'm not sure that the actuarial concern, the AFSCME and MAPE don't have any problems with the bill. They would be the folks who would be concerned with that in some sense, I think. And because people are paying in, you know, fully in a sense, I suppose that could change the premium cost if you get a particularly different kind. But they would rate you, then it's insurance, so you'd be rated on an individual basis anyway. It's not like a health insurance pool, right? Where you're paying the same premiums for everybody.
Okay, Representative Loeffler.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Keith, it just depends on how Dewar built bid it. If they bid it on a book of, you know, a certain book of demographics, then it, the prices are based on that.
You know, maybe this other person would want to come down and explain what he's explaining. Because we're all kind of hearing it anyway a little bit. Welcome to the committee.
Hi, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is, for the record, my name is Nathan Rockwell. I'm the director of the Employee Insurance Division, and I oversee the State Employee Group Insurance Program. We're checking currently with CNA, who is the administrator of the long-term care program. As I was explaining to Representative Thiessen, that essentially the program is community rated, so we're not rated as an individual group. I would suspect that not knowing how many, what the potential pool coming in would be, it's a little difficult to say, but as you're well aware of, if the group coming in just has in general, is large enough and has a higher burden than the current group that's existing within the CNA long-term care product, then we would expect the rates to go up. But because it is community rated, my assumption would be is that it would be large enough to absorb that. But certainly as this moves through and gets to a finance committee, we would provide some testimony on what we would think would be the impact to the premium.
Okay, thank you. All right, any other questions for members? Is there anybody else who wants to testify for or against this bill? Okay, I don't see anybody. So Representative Thiessen renews his motion that House File 1889 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations, Reform, Technology, and Elections. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, no. And the bill passes. Thank you. All right, we are going to recess now and reconvene at 6:30 in this room, 200.
Her statement that she just made. As you know, our office represents thousands of people who receive nursing home care, also services in assisted living and home care. Our office has concerns about the enhanced private pay rates in House File 1334, Sections 4 and 5, and does oppose that language in the bill. For over 30 years, Minnesota has been able to point to equal rate protection, or rate equalization as we call it, with pride as a statement of Minnesota's commitment to fairness and equal treatment when the need for nursing home care arises. This law is critical to seniors in three important ways. The law ensures equal access to needed care regardless of your ability to pay. The law assures that the dignity of seniors are preserved when private funds are depleted and MA is required to pay for that care. And the law also assures that the care and services provided will not differ or change simply because of the need for MA. Ombudsmen in states without an equal rates law report numerous complaints, including MA ghettos in certain nursing homes. Despite federal laws prohibiting discrimination in admissions based on source of payment, seniors in other states without this protection report complaints about discrimination based on ability to pay, longer hospital stays for MA patients waiting for an available MA bed, embarrassment for seniors who are moved to different beds of the nursing home for those receiving MA, and a faster send down to MA, increasing costs to states. Elimination of this protection will result in a cost shift to seniors who pay out of pocket. People who are undertaking the responsibility of paying for their own care should not be penalized. This is a targeted tax on those doing their best to pay for their care out of their own pocket. Most people enter a nursing home as a private paying resident. Two-thirds of those who stay will eventually have to depend on MA to defray the cost of care. If we want to encourage people to be self-reliant in funding their nursing home stays, we should not change this good current law. Thank you for consideration of these comments. I'm going to turn it to Mark.
Welcome, Ms. May.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mark Wanders, the Executive Director of the Elder Care Rights Alliance. I'm here on behalf of our board, elders, vulnerable adults receiving long-term care services, and all the clients that we serve in Minnesota. I want to express our strong opposition to testify against rate equalization in only those provisions in Representative Gunther's bill, House File 1334, Sections 4 and 5. Elder Care Rights Alliance is a Minnesota nonprofit with 37 years of history advocating for elders and persons with disabilities in the long-term care system. Our mission is to advance the principles of justice and dignity in long-term care through education, advocacy, and action. We have supported rate equalization since its inception. I'd like to share the history of rate equalization. The law was originally passed in 1976 prohibiting nursing homes from charging a higher rate of private pay patients than those receiving medical assistance. When the law was passed, providers brought suit, and the case went on until 1983, when the state Supreme Court refused to grant certiorari. During the lawsuits, providers that charged a higher rate than MA had to keep the differential in escrow accounts, but little was done to define the standards for those accounts. In 1983 and after, once equalization was unquestionably lost, ombudsman cases erupted concerning refunds of those overcharges. Not only were they a wide variety of escrow accounts, there were companies that had gone out of business, residents who had passed away, and storylines worthy of detective novels. However, this particular statute helped overcome discrimination in nursing home admissions and ensured access to care for people who could not afford the care they urgently needed. Minnesota is one of those states that has retained that law. North Dakota, at last report, had a positive gap between Medicaid and private pay rates, which would indicate that not rate equalization is the problem to be undone, but rather how rate reimbursement for care received is set in Minnesota policy. In a 2001 article published by Madonna Harrington Meyer titled Medicaid Reimbursement Rates and Access to Nursing Homes, Implications for Gender, Race, and Marital Status, she states, Medicaid reimbursement rates vary widely around the country and at times are just 70 to 80% of the prevailing private pay rates. These differences may create economic incentives for nursing homes to discriminate against the Medicaid applicants. Older blacks and Hispanics and older unmarried persons are more likely to be on Medicaid, therefore they are more likely to face delay or denial of that admission. She goes on to state a possible policy solution comes from Minnesota, where an equalization law requires nursing home and welfare state officials to work together to set those rates, making discriminatory practices against vulnerable groups illegal. Her research goes on to state older blacks and Hispanics are nearly 50% more likely than whites to rely on Medicaid admission to nursing homes. Older not married people are 30% more likely than older married people to rely on Medicaid at admission. Thus, if there is discrimination against Medicaid applicants, it affects these groups disproportionately. No other states have solved their respective staffing or reimbursement problems by charging private pay residents more than those on public assistance. The national picture shows what happens when low Medicaid rates are combined with unlimited private pay rates. a two-tier system with poor and racial minorities losing ground all the way. In addition, those paying privately at a higher rate also would drain their private funds at a faster rate, resulting in their need to access MA much sooner, thus putting their care at the expense of federal and state dollars, ultimately the taxpayer. The phase-out or elimination of rate equalization in Minnesota as proposed in the bill only band-aids a much bigger, more complex problem inherent in our reimbursement system and places a huge redistribution of Americans' wealth tax on those who have saved and need services. The Kaiser Family Foundation 2007 data indicated 33% of residents who are private pay would be affected if you were to pass this bill as introduced, which would create a redistribution of Minnesota's wealth. In essence, Minnesota would penalize those that save properly to subsidize the state government's obligation to pay a fair price for services delivered. Minnesotans who sat around the kitchen table years ago planning for their long-term care needs would now be paying for more for equal care. A 97 report...
Stop you right there, because that's actually... I was looking at the thing that you included rather far in the packet, and Minnesota has substantially more private pay than the national average.
11% more.
Yeah. Why? Do we have any reason why that...
I can make an assumption. It's because private pay is equal to that's paid by the state.
Exactly.
So there's not an accelerated rate for people to distribute their wealth to the next generation.
Okay. Go ahead. Thanks. Yeah, Representative Ross.
Mr. Chairman, I think we need more information than just an assumption that we're going to make policy based on that, because I mean, I understand that would be a part of it, but I certainly think that there's a much bigger picture related to the entire financing system of healthcare, and in addition to that, the economy and all sorts of saving rates and things along those, the homeownership rates. I mean, I can go down the list related to that, but I do have a question after the testifier's done.
Okay. It's just an interesting, I didn't know that fact. It's worth thinking about. Okay, go ahead.
Thank you. A 97 report by the Minnesota Legislative Auditor found no evidence that rate equalization contributed to a higher average nursing home rate. Private pay individuals are already choosing assisted living facilities over nursing homes in ever-increasing proportions. If rates for privately paid care are increased, fewer private paying persons would choose a nursing home. The net result would be a decrease in nursing homes' income and an increase in the reliance on state-funded public assistance in those very homes. I think we all agree rate reimbursement isn't adequate and direct care workers are vastly underpaid. It's estimated that 40% of direct care workers nationally live in households that rely on one or more public benefits, such as Medicaid for themselves or food stamps, reflecting the heavy public subsidies required to compensate for low wages and inadequate benefits received by most direct care workers. It's a complex social issue that cannot be solved with this proposed change. The projected $23 that was referenced earlier about the Minnesota gap on average between daily Medicare rates and costs is the result of no long-range planning beyond every two-year budget to save money today and slash taxes by cutting services to those who are in need and then not indexing the true actual cost of services delivered. Minnesota law already allows providers to charge a daily room rate differential for private single rooms. These rooms are often occupied by private pay individuals. Some exceptions are granted under Medicaid for recipients who have complex medical conditions and often it is family members who pay for this private perk, even for individuals receiving Medicaid care. So an additional luxury tax already exists for private pay individuals. It's inevitable that something must be done to balance how the state pays and cares for those who are unable. Whether we want to hold them accountable for not taking personal responsibility prior to needing long-term health care services is another debate. I'll bet the issue of sufficient reimbursement is a necessary discussion that needs to happen soon. In closing, these particular provisions of the bill are not the end-all solution that will solve our nursing home's financial crises. A solution crafted in a more balanced fashion with considerations for both the consumer and the provider will ultimately be much more effective. We don't want to go back to the days when ailing individuals with limited savings were stuck in hospitals waiting for a Medicaid nursing home bed. Without rate equalization, 33 years of equality in state policy to give way to delayed and denied care, not to mention a potential for financial exploitation of private paying elders. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess a couple things. First of all, I guess I'm a little frustrated with the inflammatory language related to the MA ghettos. Even if
we did this policy, which I agree needs careful consideration and a lot of thought around it. There's no doubt about it. Minnesota does not have that culture in our state. And so to suggest that we would become a ghetto, a MA ghetto in the nursing homes, I think is an insult to them. And I would just caution us on something this sensitive. This is a sensitive issue, no doubt about it. It's not a partisan issue, it's a sensitive issue. But we've got to talk about how we start fixing this problem, because we do have a big problem. Not only a big problem today, but we have an increasing problem down the road. But I just found that somewhat insulting, not to me personally, to the nursing homes that are working hard and to the folks who are working hard within those homes. The other comment, I guess I'm not understanding how having people pay for the services they get is a tax. The idea that you mentioned that study talked about unlimited private pay, but that's not what this proposal does. This proposal caps the private pay based on cost. And so I think it's important, as we have this discussion, that we use facts and that we actually base our testimony and our information on what the bill actually does. And I think that's a big, big difference. And I agree with you if you're going to see a huge differential. But Representative Gunther's bill is careful in that it is attempting to hold it to cost, which I just honestly am baffled as to how that could be a tax. So I guess that was more comment than question, Mr. Chairman, but I look forward to continuing this discussion. I don't think it's an easy one. It's not a fun one, but it certainly is an important one worthy of very careful consideration by all of us.
Representative Lieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I kind of have some of the same concerns as Representative Broad. And I'm certainly not prepared to vote tonight to get rid of rate equalization. I mean, let me be really clear about that. I think we do need to have much more discussion around that, and also without the inflammatory language, I think. But I wanted to say is we have hospitals in the state, and we don't have rate equalization for them. And yet we don't have, I mean, I think some of the arguments you advance for rate equalization are probably true, but the horror stories, if they were going to happen by getting rid of it, wouldn't we be seeing that in our hospitals where we do have different rates? Could you please address that?
Either one of you. Not Representative Gunther, I don't think. You can if you want, but I think
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, in hospitals we have cost shifting. When you have the huge population that we have in my district of seniors and poor people on Medicaid and Medicare, hospitals cannot exist without cost charging more to people of means or have health insurance. They would not be there, the doctors would not be there, we would be without hospitals. So certainly there is cost equalization in everything that we do. And we do have a disproportionate share of poor and old in greater Minnesota. In fact, the average family income of my district is 55% of what the average family income is in the metro area. And as far as Latinos and minorities are concerned, we don't have one Latino residence in one nursing home in my district except those people that work there. So we certainly don't discriminate against anyone in my district. And I feel very offended by that. So I really think that we're just asking to cover the cost of the people there. We don't mind taking the bump for people who can't afford it, but we would like to cover the cost. And that's all I ask.
Representative Lieber.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Gunther, that's kind of my point, that hospitals cost shift, and that's kind of how they make it. And we don't, what I was getting to was, if we're going to see this terrible discrepancy in treatment between people, why don't we see that in our hospitals? That was kind of my question. Not for you so much, Representative Gunther, but for your testifier. Not your testifier, the opponent.
Any. If you have a response, that's fine. If not, that's fine, too.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I can't answer that. I have to plead ignorance on that issue. I do want to address the offensiveness in the inflammatory statement. I would like to apologize if people took offense to that. And what I want to reiterate is that that was not a comment about any nursing homes in Minnesota. Those are comments from many, many other ombudsmen in many other states of the problems that they have seen and their wording. But I would like to apologize for that. Thank you.
Ms. Allen. Karina Allen. Unless there's other questions. Welcome to the committee.
My name is Karina Allen, and I'm a senior. I've been over here many times in the past lobbying on health care issues, especially in long-term care. I started in the late 70s lobbying for home health. The alternative care program was the first. I have never received a salary for lobbying. I have worked in 7 hospitals, 3 of them Army hospitals, and 1 nursing home. I want to speak to the equalization law, which was one of the many laws to improve nursing home care, and nursing homes have improved greatly. Since we passed those laws, the reason for the law was we wanted to get away from a two-tiered system of health care. It's difficult to get equally good health care for both groups. Before equalization, most of the good homes had 2 lists. If one were going to be a medical assistant patient, or in the near future, the home didn't have a bed. If one had money, there was a bed. The medical assistance class is made up of many people from the upper and middle classes that have run out of money paying for their health care. They are the hardest to take care of because they expect to be treated as they were before. The very poor have been kicked around enough, they don't expect much. And there has been a difference in hospitals. I have worked at the old General Hospital. We didn't have air conditioning and large wards. After we got the equalization law, the poor care homes seemed to disappear and the good homes multiplied, because they got paid as much taking care of medical assistance patients as private paid. A study done a few years ago comparing Minnesota rates with Wisconsin rates showed Wisconsin, which doesn't have equalization, had rates for private paid patients 40% higher. That will push people into medical assistance sooner. Before equalization, when one was no longer private pay, they might be moved to another section of the home or another floor. Some homes had no beds available for when the patient needed to return to the home after they were hospitalized. They did for the private pay patients. I worked with this. We would sometimes have to keep patients in the hospital because we couldn't find a medical assistance bed. That costs a lot of money. When we tell some people they had to go to the nursing homes have improved in this state a great deal. We have some very wonderful homes. But I can recall telling the one man, well, you have terminal cancer, you're going to have to go to a nursing home to be taken care of. He said, I'll commit suicide before I'll do that. People would cry. Sometimes you didn't tell them where they were going to go. The ambulance just took them there. I don't want to see that return. Thank you for listening to me.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for the Representative Root? Has it a comment? Go ahead.
And maybe a question too. I think it's been a fascinating discussion to me. And I one question I have, and I don't know, Representative Gunther, if you know the answer to this, but it sounds like part of the history of why things are the way they are is so we don't have a two-tiered system, as I'm understanding. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if we've achieved that. Do we see in the demographics, is there kind of a distribution in the nursing homes what you see, you know, in the general population, is it reflective? And I guess the other point is just kind of Representative Liebling mentioned about we maybe see differences in our hospitals, you know, and I think we do. I think that's health disparity. I think that's documented. So, I mean, just a thought.
Okay.
That's
good.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, and to the testifiers, and also I want to comment to Representative Gunther, because I do know that his heart is in this. I, too, am in my 60s looking forward to my first Social Security check. I am not looking forward to entering the nursing home, however, although I've worked in the best one in Minnesota, you all know. But and also, I have to say and add comments to Ms. Allen, it's very, very painful to watch someone come in, a private pay patient with a farm or their home, like I have, my home of 39 years that's paid for. Should something happen to myself or my husband, and we go in as private pay, because times they are a-changing with nursing home people. We now have nursing home insurance, my husband and I, and a policy where we never saw that before. We saw a farm or a home, and then when that was gone, you are broke. And that happens within 2 to 4 years, and that is very painful to have observed hundreds of those folks. And these are tools, Representative Gunther, and I thank you for being brave and bringing them forward. We have some of them are not as sharp as we need them to be, but we're working on it. So thank you.
Okay. Representative Gunther, the last word. And
last word.
Yes. Thank you for coming down.
Ms. Allen, I appreciate all your services in the past, and I certainly remember when there was private rooms for one person, the rest of the people stayed two per room. I remember that when I was a young kid going to visit my grandparents. So I appreciate it. But I don't remember the wards. But anyway, they aren't where I live. But anyway, I'm glad I had this opportunity to present this. I apologize to the committee for having this bill take so long. It was not my intent. And I apologize to Representative Swalwick for taking so long. And I thank you for your patience and your consideration.
Okay, we're going to lay the bill over, and then we may see pieces of it coming back. So, thank you, Representative Gunther. Representative Swalwick. Okay, I'll move that House File 1811 be recommended and passed and referred to the Committee on Finance, and also move the A1 amendment just to get the bill in the shape the office would like it. All in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye. All opposed, no. Motion is adopted. Representative Swalwick.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Tonight before you, I am bringing the Autism Spectrum Disorder Joint Legislative Task Force. Where this bill comes from is, you probably know, maybe the Senate had a Senate Autism Task Force that they established last year, and that's a meeting for last year. And tonight I have the chair of that, Brad Trehane, with me. And they have just given a report, which I think the report is in your packet, I'm hoping, which talks about the good work that they have done.
So we have it in our packets.
You have it in your packet, and that'll talk a little bit about
this thing right here?
Yep.
Okay.
So what they've done, they had two public forums, family perspectives and professional perspectives. They did a public survey, and then have a summary of the work that they've been doing. Mm-hmm. And what they found is, because of autism is such a big issue, that they really need some additional time to work on this, and at the same time would like to work with the House. So now it would be a House-Senate Joint Legislative Task Force. The way the bill is structured is, in paragraph A, it creates the task force. B lists the composition. There would be 25 members on the task force. C talks about the departments and their work, and we've been negotiating with the departments on potentially some language there. Paragraph D is deleted in the amendment. Paragraph E requires the chair to be elected at the first meeting. And paragraph F really talks about the work of the task force, which would be to consider ways to improve services, sources of public funding available for treatment, methods to coordinate and improve service delivery, methods to improve and increase training, ways to educate families and the public about autism spectrum disorders. Paragraph G requires task force to issue a report to the legislature. So, Mr. Chairman, members, it's a pretty simple bill. I think all of you, when you're out in your districts and whether you're campaigning or going to activities, we all know that autism is on the rise, at least being diagnosed, and we know that it's a big issue. And I think this is a way we can continue to try to find good solutions to get on top of what the treatments are and what directions we should be headed in. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to have my witness speak as well.
Welcome. Chair Houston, members of the committee, thank you so much. My name is Brad Trahan from Rochester, Minnesota. Currently just served as chair on the Senate Autism Task Force that Representative Slaug just talked about. The Minnesota Senate Autism Task Force was adopted by a voice vote on May 17, 2008. Autism is a very complex disorder with many unanswered questions. Many Minnesotans are depending on the existing task force as well as any future task forces to help them utilize Minnesota's existing services in a much more efficient manner, as well as to make recommendations regarding how to improve services. In 2008, the state total for individuals birth through 21 years who are identified as meeting the special education eligibility requirements for autism spectrum disorders, ASD, was 12,704. This was an increase over the previous year, and the percent of increase in each of the past 5 years has been between 12 to 17%. We did host two public forums. The first one was on November 13th, titled The Family's Perspective. Oral testimony was taken from 46 people, and in addition, another 66 individuals shared stories via our email address. We heard from parents, grandparents, and guardians who literally cried for help, and from those who are simply worn out and frustrated because it's so difficult for them to navigate the system as each of our 87 counties operate differently. It was made loud and clear to the task force that rural and greater Minnesota is struggling due to the lack of services provided to them. As one writer wrote, we love up north, but that does not mean there is not autism up here. We had public forum number two, which was titled Professional Perspective. We had physicians, educational professionals, support services, teachers, paraprofessionals, social services, and therapy providers, extended home care providers, all give us their testimony. About 100 people were in attendance. 16 people testified, and 34 wanted to express their written testimony. The first public forum generated tremendous emotion as we heard of the many challenges faced by families. In the second forum, the professionals echoed these challenges and sent the common message that better collaboration and coordination in addressing all aspects of ASD is critically needed. The testimony given in our professional perspective forum reinforced many of the concerns expressed by individuals and families in the first forum and proved an education for us all. Of particular note was the expressed need for better collaboration and coordination amongst us all. We also conducted a statewide survey for approximately a month and a half. 1,407 Minnesotans responded to questions regarding autism in Minnesota. The great number of people who completed the 19-question survey between January 5th and February 15th without any incentive demonstrates the importance of autism issues in Minnesota. The financial impact was huge. 77% feel that obtaining affordable autism therapy or treatment is a great problem, rating it as a 4 to 5 in a 1 to 5 scale of problems. 90% of families reported that their family has faced moderate to great deal of financial stress related to autism diagnosis. And finally, 76% report that family member has had to stop or decrease work due to autism. In summary, the task force recognizes the current economic situation and feels that a report of recommendations containing fiscal implications is simply not practical. While there will always be differing opinions on a variety of issues relating to autism, one thing has been made very clear to this task force. Much work is not only needed, rather warranted. The task force hopes that the work accomplished these past 6 months will be a reflection of what is better yet to come, and that one day our children and family members can better navigate the complex system, which would alleviate much stress on families. It's our hope that Minnesota will work in unison to coordinate its ideas and resources to better help our children and their families. Therefore, it is imperative that the state of Minnesota act to fulfill the original charge of this task force. We strongly recommend that the legislature and the governor act to establish a task force
with a longer time frame that will be able to make a full range of in-depth recommendations and assist the state in coordinating interagency and intergovernmental efforts to address issues of concern related to autism and its effects on individuals, families, schools, and units of government.
Thank you. Any questions, members? Okay, thank you for coming up again. Oh, Representative Leland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Trahan, good to see you here tonight.
Good to see you.
To you or Representative Flout, is it common in for us to establish task forces for particular disorders, particular developmental disabilities, particular mental illnesses, particular other kinds of illnesses? I mean, what's the history of this kind of thing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, and I've been here 10 years, and I actually think I've been on Health and Human Services most of those. I think it depends. I mean, you know, I think we all know this legislature probably has more task forces than a lot of them, or has proposed more, because I think we had a change in leadership, and we're all very interested. And also, when you aren't sure what to do about an issue, for example, Representative Norton, and I don't think she's here. Is she in the room? She has a bill on autism to address the health insurance issue, but beyond that, there are also many other issues. So I don't know, Mr. Chair, if I actually do know the legislative history. It kind of ebbs and flows with who's in charge and the majority-minority, and I think in particular in the last two bienniums, you've seen more task forces because we're interested in trying to work on solutions before we propose them and pass bills. We want to be more sure what we're passing, and I think that's part of it here is the solution is not crystal clear here, whether helping, you know, having everybody covered would just solve this. Why is diagnoses up so much? How are kids being diagnosed? I mean, there's just a lot of issues out there.
Thanks, Chair and members. I represent Leland. It's a great question, and I think it's what, in the past 6 years, on a personal perspective, what I've seen is many great agencies, many great people come up to St. Paul talking to respective legislators. But at the same token, what was really important in this task force is we had to unite as one. If we all come to you folks and tell you 20 different things, you'll be bouncing off the walls. We need to make it easier for you that so when we come and bring legislation to our legislators that it's clear, it's concise, and we unite. And what's happened, that wasn't going on, so we're hoping this task force would do that.
For some reason.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure that that'll help us stop bouncing off the walls. I think we do a lot of that around here. But I guess, Representative Flout, my question is more focused around, you know, I know we have lots of task forces around different policy areas, but do we have them around particular disorders, particular illnesses, particular developmental disabilities?
Mr. Chair, I can ask staff for any help on that? I'm not sure.
Well, we certainly would have things like that occur with the Council on Disability. I mean, I don't think it's unheard of to do something related to a specific type disorder, but I don't know from a legislative standpoint. Heck, we can be trailblazers, Representative Liebling.
Okay, Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Slawick. I have two questions. The first is, I too agree we have all kinds of task forces, and I think the task force is where much of the real work gets done. When we have these interim commissions and meetings where we can really kind of sit down a little longer term, really evaluate the evidence, have experts come in, those kinds of things. So it's a real important part of what we do here at the Capitol. In my limited, a little over 2 year experience here at the Capitol so far, though, these task forces usually all have a limited time span, most of them less than a year. They're usually designated over the interim between sessions to come back and report for the next session to give recommendations. I'm concerned about the lack of I think this is a huge area with a lot of unknowns about it, so I can imagine it taking several years to get a handle on this more effectively, and I can imagine needing to revisit over time. But I would be more comfortable, unless I didn't read it carefully enough, I don't see an end date, I would be more comfortable in this going forward the rest of the session if it had a sunset, I mean, a limit on it, and then we could revisit it then to continue it.
if we think it's been, particularly if there's any dollars attached to it at all. And that could be two years or 4 years or something, but I think that many of us probably feel more comfortable with that. So first of all, your comments on that. And then secondly, I had a question about the makeup of the task force of the 25 members. It appears only four or so are behavioral specialists or physicians, those kinds of folks. And I wondered if you can, out of the 25, which I think is a little bit smaller number than I expected to see here of those types of folks. So can you kind of explain to me your understanding of why that is and what kind of the overall intent is and how that affected your makeup of the task force?
Mr. Chair and Representative Bunn, on your first question regarding the end date, yes, we saw that as an oversight and we've been talking about that. We would prefer 2 years. Mr. Chair, I don't know if you want an oral amendment tonight or I think it goes to Representative Huntley's committee if you want us to do a...
Well, and we could talk about... I don't know why this is not going to Representative Pawlowski's committee.
Well, my understanding from staff is that Representative Pawlowski said if it's going to be rolled into an omnibus bill that it doesn't have to stop there. Is that right, Ms. Hayes?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pawlowski, what I was told by another member of House Research was if the bill establishes a task force or a study group and it's going to be rolled into an omnibus finance bill, it does not need to go to Representative Pawlowski's committee.
Okay. And is this going to go under your bill, huh? Is that the plan? Okay. Okay. Well, then we're going to take more time to work on the... We're going to have to do Pawlowski's work here, I guess, then, tonight. So, okay. Representative Lieber, go ahead, Representative Lieber.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I do have concerns about that, and I spoke earlier today with Representative Kahn, and obviously she's not Representative Pawlowski, but she has chaired that committee. Yeah. Well, sometimes it's hard to tell people apart, But she is the chair of the State Government Finance Committee, and she has a lot of experience in this area, and she did tell me that she thought that it should go to his committee, and I do have some concerns about that because... I did sit on that committee in my first term, and I don't know about this rule about skipping the committee if you're going into an omnibus bill, but it seemed to me from when I was on that they wanted to see every one of these. So I would be much more comfortable if we did send it to Representative Pawlowski.
Mr. Chair, I can deal with the wishes of the committee. However, my understanding is he's out of time. That he's booked already. So that's
where is this in the Senate?
My understanding, yes, Mr. Trahan, to comment.
Chair, we have a hearing on Friday morning at 10 a.m.
Okay. So it's going to meet deadline in the Senate.
Yeah.
Okay. I feel more comfortable going to Pawlowski's committee with this one too. I know that we've talked about this in the past with him about some of the work groups we did on the reform, but this is a fairly substantial task force, I think, that, and we don't know, well, Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure if the testifier's response established firmly for us that meets deadline in the Senate. If they have more than one policy committee to go through in the Senate, that doesn't necessarily mean that deadline is being heard on Friday, because they're also going through their equivalent of government ops. They may not be meeting deadlines. So if your decision right here depends on that in any way, I would want us to know for sure what we're
He has no... he only has three bills up tomorrow and three bills on Thursday, the last I looked.
Well, we've been talking about this all day, and I'm still trying to figure this out, so it's... Mr. Chair, if we send it there, as long as I can get a hearing, I suppose if I can't, we can always do a re-referral on the floor.
Okay. Well, people have other questions. Well, Representative, so the first question is whether we put in a sunset on the bill, and maybe we can have staff kind of work on a two-year sunset language. You had a second question, though.
I have language for the sunset, if you'd like it.
Sure.
Okay. Shall I make a motion to do that then?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I move that we insert after line 3.8 an H, a section H,
which would read, this section expires June 30th, 2011, period.
Okay, everybody understand that motion? Any discussion? Oh, it's going to end June 30th, 2011. This section expires June 30th, 2011. Okay. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
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 All opposed? Okay. Controversial, apparently. And then you had a second question.
Yeah, my second question to Representative Wallach, she probably remembers, is about the makeup of the committee, the task force, and how that dovetailed with its intent. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Munn, just a little bit of history on this task force. I actually had introduced another bill that was a task force. If you look in my bills, I have two of these. One was when it was going to continue from the Senate, and one was when I was just interested in doing it because I have a couple of bills on autism. So I will tell you what things I wanted included, and then I would like Mr. Trahane to speak about the Senate and their process that they went through, since they had already been through this for a year. In our case, you know, very frankly, the Speaker is supportive of this, and so my part was lines 1.9 to 1.13, which was about the members from the Senate and House. That before that, the current committee, there is, I know there's a senator, but there obviously it's a Senate Autism Task Force, so there's no House members. So we added, of course, there's two members of the Senate, one from the majority and one from the minority, and two members from the House, and the majority and the minority. That's the part that I had input in for this extensively. The other part is the Senate really drafted the bill and came to me with this. So I would like to turn to the testifier and have Tim talk about it, because they have a current one, and maybe he could talk about how this differs from math and why.
Chair Thiessen, Representative Bond, thank you. We did meet on March 4th and then again on March 11th, and of the current makeup of the Senate Task Force, we had 10 members representing different agencies that I've included in your packet that we submitted to the governor. And for a couple of weeks, we, as a group, narrowed this list down, talking about the professionals, the advocacy groups, the PACER. Of course, it was important for us to include someone in the Somalian agency due to the concerns that we are facing with that. So as a collaborative effort, we took this up. Actually, this list started out at 46. So I took that 46 and we narrowed it down to 30, and we got to 25, just thinking 46 was too many. So as a team effort, that's how we got that, through the numbers we did. And through the recommendations of the, you know, we wanted some behavioral therapists on there, some physicians, and just to make this as neutral as we possibly could.
Ms. Commit, did you have some testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I thought it would be nice for me to come before the committee and tell you that I support this bill. I'm Catherine Smith from the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, and we support the bill to create a task force to examine autism treatment and how to improve services, how to improve training for service providers, and most importantly, how to examine and review the scientific research and what the research says about what's the most effective treatment for children who suffer from this. So I think this is a great idea. I think this is the way that we should be coming to, as Brad said more articulately than I did, figuring out what the issues are and then coming forward with a bill or a proposal that's more succinct and has all of the issues fully thought through. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to ask DHS to come down because we had a discussion today, and just to, as we're getting towards the end of the process here, they had talked to me about potentially having a fiscal note on this, which I usually wouldn't bring right up, except that we think that we can have a way around that. And so I would like you to introduce yourself and let's talk about that a little bit.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Heidi Hamilton with the Department of Human Services. We did speak with Representative Slavik because the way that the language is currently worded, we believe there would be a fiscal note for the Department of Human Services. But as I talked with
with Representative Flowick about, we're willing to work with her on the language to make it neutral for the department.
We don't know what that is yet, though.
Right.
Okay. Okay.
We do have some, and we have some ideas, right. But I think we're going to need to work on that between now and the next stop. So it should be fiscally neutral.
Well, then maybe you can go right from the floor after Representative Flowick's committee.
Of course. That's the ideal.
And it did get, went to the equivalent of Representative Pelosi's committee in the Senate, so I think that will be the last stop. It never went to Representative Marty or Senator Marty's committee.
Mm.
Okay. So, any further discussion on the bill? Representative Brown.
I just had a quick question for the department. I'm looking at page 2 of the bill, and was the fiscal note related to, or the potential of a fiscal note related to the additional services that the Department of Human Services was going to have to provide? And do you feel that on line 2.17, those responsibilities you can do within your budget?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Chair, Representative Broad, the areas that we felt were contributing to the fiscal note was the requirement for the department to provide substantive assistance, which is on line 2.18, and then also the sentence beginning on line 2.21, where the department shall provide any other information that is deemed necessary. So it was both of those. And then, Mr. Chairman, and maybe Representative Flawick, it would appear to me then, if that was, I was trying to define which part was the problem you had in related to the fiscal note. If it's the first on 2.17, I would imagine the Department of Education and Employment and Economic Development would have the same problem. So does your fix that problem too for them?
Ms. Hamilton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Broad, I haven't spoken with those departments, so I can't speak on their behalf.
Okay. Any further discussion on the bill? Okay. Thank you, Representative Flowers, for your persistence on this issue. I know you've been at it all session, so I appreciate that. I will renew my motion, and I'll amend it, that House File 1811 be recommended, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations and Elections and what have you. So, okay. All those in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Okay, Representative Huntley. And I guess we're going to do 1832 first.
Yeah.
So, Representative Huntley will move that House File 1832 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Finance.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to have a series of bills that were an attempt by Senator Berglund and myself to come up with some ways to save money in our budget. Many of these we do not have fiscal notes yet. The idea is that it's got to get to a fiscal committee before you can basically demand that they give us a fiscal note. Some of these are good ideas, some I support. I'll talk about two that I don't support in this, and we'll deal with that in a minute. But this particular bill, 1832, and I have somebody here testifying. Sets up a medical review team.
Is your amendment, that's a separate bill,
that's
right?
Separate.
Okay, so we'll do this first and then put that on. Okay.
And to take people that have disabilities to try to identify what their disabilities are, to quantitate them, and partly it's to make it easier for these people to get on SSI, I think.
Yes.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
How are you?
Good. Go ahead. Committee members. My name is Ann Quincy. I'm an attorney at the Legal Aid Society of Minneapolis. I do practice in the area of social security law. As Representative Huntley mentioned, the state medical review team comes up quite a bit in my work because other than a social security disability determination, the other way that disabled people get medical assistance is by being placed in that category of disabled. They have to have a determination of disability.
unlike some of the other categories of eligibility for MA with our a parent. That is, they're a pregnant woman, they're a child, they're aged, blind. For the disability category, you have to be determined disabled by either Social Security or the state medical review team. The state medical review team is the entity that, by doing that determination, makes sure that people are not on perhaps general assistance medical care with purely state funds, or Minnesota care with state funds if they're single adults, when they should be on medical assistance with the federal match, and getting the full panoply of services that medical assistance can provide. If you'd like, I'll go through the sections. Section 1 directs the department to assist people who need that disability determination with the process. Right now, the process can be quite lengthy. 7,000 applications were processed last year, 7,000 disability determinations were processed by the state medical review team, and 30%, 18% were denied, 12% were withdrawn. We'd like to see more assistance from the commissioner so that those applications don't go by the wayside if the person is actually eligible. The latter part of Section 1 requires DHS to provide information on the state medical review team's results to the legislative committees overseeing health and human services finance. We've met with DHS, and particularly with Section 1's A and B, made some changes that, while not changing the meaning, just make it more clear when the commissioner will step in. That is, before a denial, before there's a decision that there's insufficient evidence, the commissioner will coordinate that application to make sure that the evidence that's necessary gets in. Section 2 specifies simply, as the health research described, specifies how disability will be determined to make sure that the Social Security process is used. And it does that later on as well with the MAEPD program, so that uses, again, the Social Security process, J, at line 426.
Any questions on, so what, the state medical review team exists today?
It does, Your Honor. It exists today, and actually, it's the only direction a person might find to it is in the Minnesota State Rules, which tell us that it's definition, and that it's to make determinations of disability. But it's a part of the Department of Human Services, and we thought by formalizing the process better in the legislation, we'd make that more clear. The cost savings that come from this that the representative discussed are that when people are on the wrong program, when people with high costs, high medical costs, for instance, who are disabled, are sitting on general assistance medical care, they tend to have larger medical bills. That's why we'd like the information to go to the Finance Committee regarding hospitalizations, and to go to the Finance Committee regarding hospitalizations, health insurance coverage, and their application for Social Security. They tend to have high medical bills, which should be either paid for with medical assistance with the federal match, or they might not have such high medical bills if they were able to access better services, such as PCA services at home, instead of hospital services.
Okay, so just what is this review team? Do they review Social Security applications, or what?
It's an alternative to the Social Security process. Mr. Chairman, you either go through the Social Security process, which, frankly, is taking an incredible amount of time now. It can take up to 2 years to get a disability determination completed through the Social Security process. If you're found eligible, you'll get retroactive benefits. The state will recoup medical assistance retroactively as well. But during that time, you should be on the right program. So if you're waiting for that, you can get a state medical review team determination of disability, hopefully more promptly. Frankly, we wanted this process to speed it up as well.
And the reason that we're coordinating with the Social Security criteria? Will a determination by this board actually speed that process up?
No, Chairman, Mr. Chairman, it won't. It's, as I say, it's an alternative. It must use that process, the same process that the Social Security created in the Social Security Act by Medicaid regulation.
Oh, I see. Okay. All right. That's what you qualify. You meet the right criteria to qualify. Okay. Right. Representative Abler.
I think that I'm sorry I was late. I was doing a different bill. Maybe it was covered, but I can understand how this would save money by moving them from a program that's got shared costs and maybe reducing some other secondary health costs. But is this team also going to tell people that really you don't qualify and that you should quit applying? Is that implied here? Mm-hmm. I know in that as we try to right-size the people in our programs, which I think is one way we can soft land some of these programs in the challenging times we're in, I think it would be important for them that this team could say, you really don't qualify, and there's no reason to go through four more times of this. Is that implied, or is that part of it, or could that be part of it later or something? Representative Huntley, do you know? Or whoever.
Ms. Quinn, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, actually, of the 7,000 applications for the state medical review team to determine disability, disability was determined in 70%. That standard, that number used to be 90%. Actually, the paperwork that comes in is usually the winnowing process. People don't apply over and over again. It's just a process for getting on medical assistance instead of general assistance medical care.
Thank you. And just to relate, and my son is deployed, and so we went to the meeting about that, and the woman came in from some veterans assistance group, and they were telling you how to get disability if you even were by a loud cannon somewhere. And so I think that we want to make sure we're helping people that truly need it, especially as we're having to make choices. So, and I think that's fine testimony, but I think that may help with a small part of our budget challenge. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much for coming in tonight. Do you want to move your amendment?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, then I would move the amendment, which is 1832A2. And this simply requests that that human services have, when they receive an application, that a individual will coordinate that so that these people don't drop out of the system. And it also, Subdivision 7 basically requires that individuals signing up for medical assistance be given the choice of two or more healthcare homes or primary care clinics so that they can have their care coordinated. That may require a waiver, and so that's why we're looking for federal approval of a waiver.
Okay. Any questions on the amendment? Okay, all in favor of the A2 amendment say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Any more discussion on the bill? All right, Representative Huntley will renew his motion that House Bill 1832 be recommended to pass and sent to the Finance Committee as amended. All those in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. 16. I don't know, do you have any preference? 1646?
Why don't we do a, let's see here. 1561.
Okay.
And this sets up a pilot project involving...
Huntley will move 1561 to recommend that passing. We refer to the Finance Committee.
Actually, I think it should go to...
Transportation, sorry.
State and local government ops. Because it requires the city of Minneapolis or the county to do certain things. And it in the Senate, it went to GovOps, and it will be heard on Friday.
Transportation and transit policy, Representative Hornstein actually asked to see the bill.
Okay.
So we'll send it there first, I think.
Because I think they'll get the deadline taken care of in the Senate.
Yeah. So we're going to go, so the bill is, the motion is to go to Transportation, Transit Policy and Oversight Division. And we can go directly there, I think, yes.
Okay. We have gentlemen here to testify. Basically, there's a lot of overuse of ambulances to go to hospitals when it is really not an emergency, and they ought to go by some other medical transportation, which would be more cost-effective. So this is an attempt to set up a pilot project that will encourage people to use special transportation rather than the ambulance services. I will say I have a little personal experience with this. Not going to special transportation, but when my wife had a serious incident in our house, and the fire department got there first and determined that she was probably going to survive for a while. Then the ambulance came, and they decided that her condition was okay enough that I could drive her to the hospital, except that the ambulance followed right behind my car, so I don't know. And I don't know who paid their bills, but this is an attempt to get people in a pilot project so that they will use the appropriate method of getting to a hospital. And Mr. McElpin.
Thank you, Ms. Shotley. Madam Chair and members, Buck McElpin, President, Minnesota Ambulance Association. We've talked about this idea through our association for a few years. Senator Berglund asked us about it this year, too. And as we looked at ideas to maybe save on some costs, we put this pilot project together. We chose Hennepin County mainly because of the high volume between North Memorial, Hennepin County, a line of medical transportation, a little bit of Ridgeview, and Edina Fire. We do about 115,000 requests for service in that area. Quite a diverse geographic area that we cover. Basically, what the pilot project would do is ambulances would still be dispatched to the scenes, but now we don't have the ability to take patients to clinics or to urgent cares. We have to go to emergency rooms, and that's a federal Medicare law for us. If we use different forms of transportation and we arrived at somebody's home and consulted with the patient, the example we use is someone with a baby with diaper rash, and say this really isn't a reason to tie up $1.5 million paramedic staffed ambulance. Can you go down to the doctor's office that's open at 2 this afternoon on Saturday in one of our vehicles? We would arrange transportation for them through one of the special transportation providers. A couple of the ambulance companies own their own special transportation companies. Well, we'd have to do a contractual relationship to be sure we were getting folks to the right facility. And mainly because we want to track the data. Some of the data we've seen from other states off these pilots, some are successful, some are not successful. I think we have a better EMS system here in Minnesota, so I think we'd have a little better luck with it. And one thing that we have is a very active medical direction group that oversees our ambulance services. So basically the bill's before you, and if anybody has questions, we can sure answer them about it.
All right, thank you. And Representative Pompey, you have an amendment here.
That is another bill, so why don't we direct the questions to this part first, and then I'll do the amendment.
Questions for members. Representative Ruth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize, you maybe addressed this. So at what point in this transaction is the decision made then? I mean, does the ambulance actually have to show up at the house, and you say it looks like it's just like rest, so the ambulance still has to go out to the home, or can you discern that before you actually sit there? No.
Madam McAlpin.
Madam Chair, Representative Rood. Yes, the main reason we'd need the ambulance to respond is we were just talking about with Representative Bunn. About half of the 911 calls that come in and they're routed through our pre-arrival centers are very sophisticated. Some of them go into a pre-arrival code where they go through and decide you're actually having a heart attack or things you should do and give you directions. But a lot of the calls we get in certain parts of our service area, they don't like law enforcement to show up or other type of the fire department. So they'll say it's stomach pain when it could be an overdose. So the ambulance would have to respond because we really couldn't get the good data up front to make sure that it was an emergency or wasn't an emergency.
Can you follow up, Representative Ruth?
No, I can't. Yes, I guess that's so there still would be savings even though the ambulance has to go make that initial trip.
Yeah, Madam Chair, yeah. I think I can explain that a little better. What we set up in here, and there's not a price in here, and what we've talked about with the health plans is, like any healthcare entity, they get the worst side of our business, they get the cost shifting. So what might be $1,200 for an ambulance ride to a Blue Cross patient is roughly $500 to a medical assistance patient. So what we talked about is, and we don't have a number yet, we're still working with Senator Berglund, Representative Huntley on that in finance, is that a $100 evaluation fee and $50 for the special transportation vehicle. But that's where the savings would be, is instead of a $500 bill to the Department of Human Services or $1,200 to Medica for a transport, we would capture it in offering a lower form of transportation.
Okay, Representative Rood, you look like you might have another question on that. Okay, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to our guests. I'm a little confused. I don't see anyone from Hennepin here. And as I recall, as a public health function, Hennepin County operates or staffs the regional EMS services for the whole metropolitan area, and there's been territory established and protocols established, and I'm seeing like this requires that the ambulance services be provided by any ambulance service in Hennepin, and it's got an advisor committee that really is more about it looks more broad-based than perhaps some of the existing regional EMS advisory board. And so could you just give me a little more context of, does this exempt it from the current regional EMS plan, which I thought was developed with everyone's input, and has Hennepin County taken a position, or has the regional EMS board taken a position on this?
Mr. McAlpin.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, great question. It's the ambulance licensing law, our primary service area law. We do operate in exclusive licensed areas. And what you're referring to is the Hennepin County EMS Council. We have been in discussions with them about this bill. So far, they seem supportive. It still has to go back to this group. And we may have to apply for a variance, because in Hennepin County, the ambulances operate under what's called Ordinance 9, which means every 911 response requires two paramedics to respond. And so there's actually a meeting this Friday that they're discussing this bill with the medical directors, because that's one thing that it is allowed under the ordinance to apply for the variance, and we would have to work with them on that. And we've been meeting with Susan Gaines, the executive director of the EMS Council, to talk about that piece of it.
Follow-up, Representative Loeffler.
I just hope that we'll hear back on what the results of those meetings are. Because I do think it's important. I mean, I think it's important to test new things, but it's also important to make sure that it doesn't leave some part of the system out, or it's sort of somehow integrated into what seems to be a planful process that involves lots of people.
Okay, Representative Beeson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And the thing that struck me about this bill is, one of the things I hear about a lot is people who call the ambulance services, and maybe you guys have talked about this, so I've been gone, for reasons that, you know, I hear from ambulance drivers who show up and for the easy trip. It's just kind of the transportation they use instead of a taxi or instead of something else. Maybe you guys have already gone over this, but this seems to kind of be getting at solving some of that problem and moving us toward using the less expensive kind of transportation services, and so that's what appealed to me about the legislation.
Hey, I have a question on 2.35. You have the liability section, and you're saying that the liability for participants shall be limited according to Minnesota Statute Section 466.04. What is that?
Madam Chair, my name is O.J. Doyle. I'm also with the Minnesota Ambulance Association. So I recall that's the provision in statute that sets the liability caps for governmental units. And so the ambulance services participating in this would fall under the government caps that all government-based ambulances fall under. Right now, if you are run by a municipality, fire department, county, you fall under the tort liability caps. If you are not for profit, ambulance service doing the exact same service in the exact same conditions, you have no liability protection. And the reason this was put in was at the request of the physicians. This has never been done before in Minnesota, and we tend to make our changes slowly and carefully, and we are concerned that we couldn't get physician participation if we didn't have at least some minimal protection.
So that applies to physicians? I mean, exactly who does that cover?
Everybody in the
wouldn't otherwise be covered, Mr. Doyle.
I'm sorry, thank, Madam Chair, the list, got to find out where the, included in the list are all the people who would be a party to the pilot project. That's why we've got a pretty inclusive list of the special trans providers, ambulance service personnel, the physician medical directors, so that they would all be treated the same, because not all of the participants may necessarily be governmental units.
Okay, well, now I'm a little bit confused, because it says here transportation service providers must carry at least $1 million in liability insurance. So that being the case, why would they need to have this limited liability that we get when we get down to 2.34 and 2.35. Mr. Doyle.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that refers just to the special transportation services providers. There are minimum criteria that must be met to operate an STS business in the state, generally regulated under the Department of Transportation, but there are minimum standards, and then there are higher standards. And I believe the state law is $300,000 in liability. We would prefer to be working with reputable organizations with uniformed personnel who undergo drug testing and all that. We want to make sure that the patients are protected while we're undertaking this endeavor.
Okay. I'm asking all the questions here. Representative Cheatham.
I'm just wondering also, the cap would just apply to per incident, I think, right? And I'm assuming this is going to have to go to Representative Mulry's committee, too, to deal with that issue, but I'm assuming that you could actually get hit with two different incidents and exhaust your insurance that way as well.
Yeah.
Mr. Doyle?
Chair Representative Thiessen, yes.
Okay. Hopefully not.
Okay, Representative Barnes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I very much appreciate the direction this bill is taking us, but I have two comments, questions. One is that the whole issue that we are, this goes back to the line of question Representative Wood was pursuing, the whole issue that we're still sending ambulances to every one of these calls very much concerns me. As I've mentioned to the testifiers, we have the newspaper a couple weeks ago, Dakota County has this central triage 911 now, and they're trying to avoid sending ambulances to bike arrest situations. And I think that that's the direction we should be headed. This is, I understand that there may be some more special, different kinds of circumstances in this county that would make this type of pilot project a better place to start, but I would hope that we can go well beyond this and go statewide in the type of thing that Dakota and others are already pursuing down the road here. So my first comment, and then so back to Representative Rude's line of questioning, I think that why we were still puzzled is that we assume that the ambulance going out initially itself is a big cost. And so we're trying to grapple with the savings is. So you're, just to be clear, you're telling us that so rather than the 500 MA cost, it would be perhaps 150, 100 plus the special services, if you determine that lower cost approach would be, and that you're willing to save that 350 just on the basis that you're not taking them to the hospital in an ambulance. Are we correct in the interpretation there?
Mr. Doyle.
Madam Chair, Madam Chair, Representative Bunn, it's a little bit larger than that. A couple of different things that we would anticipate is, and I will give you a call that I went on last year. It was the famous diaper rash, which seems to become the urban legend that the legislature were called. First-time parents, absolutely panicky. A baby who was literally breathing but purple, crying like I have never seen. Panicky mom coming out to the ambulance in the street, just my child is sad, I don't know what. Put it in the back, took the vitals, obviously healthy baby with the worst case of diaper rash you have ever seen. And that's why the baby was crying for 2.5 hours straight. The way the system is now, we loaded up the baby, loaded up mom, took him to Hennepin County Medical Center. So, $800 bill for the ambulance, $1,000 to walk in the door, level one trauma center. I don't know if that's the figure, but I think that's probably pretty safe. So you've got $1,800 for diaper rash. Under a scenario that we're envisioning, the ambulance service gets to the scene, they identify the problem, and say, Mom, a baby appears to be healthy, the issue seems to be diaper rash. Now, if they demand to be taken in the ambulance, we have to take them under current law. But we could say, now, we have other means of getting you health care, your child, without taking $1.5 million ambulance to nationally registered paramedics. And they'd say, fine, we call a special transportation vehicle. Mom would be given a voucher. It doesn't change hands that she gives for the ride. Could go to the emergency room, but we're hoping as part of the study to get some urgent care clinics to agree to 24/7 hours. Okay, so here's the scenario going from almost $2,000 to say $100 for the ambulance, $50 for special transportation, $80 for now care or whatever. And it doesn't take very many of these calls where the patient is still protected, but we saved a considerable amount of money, and you do that in this county, we think we can show and extrapolate data that statewide we can make an impact. The last point, and I'm sorry I don't mean to drone on, but we can't keep buying ambulances. The reimbursements, the cost, we are operating, and I'm sure know you're tired of hearing this, but there is no fat in our system anymore. So if we're available when we're really needed, it's a much more efficient use of the system, and then I have to keep extending funds. The last thing, it doesn't matter. An ambulance costs what it costs 24 hours a day, regardless if you do one call or no calls. So I'll budget it out that way. The cost in the ambulance, the reason it's so expensive, is the cost of availability to make sure when you call 911, we're available.
Representative Bond.
Two things. One follow-up to that is, of course, we would like to hear, maybe not somebody tonight, but how we could have, a triage at their initial call with a nurse-type person or someone to maybe keep the ambulance from having to do the run initially. But my second question is on the next stage, the special transportation services. Representative Huntley gave the example, although I don't like the ambulance falling behind part, that they said you can just go in your own car. If you get to there and you've determined you really think it's a diaper rash, do we even have to call the special transportation services? Do we have options for putting them in a regular cab or asking if they have a neighbor who could take them, or could they drive themselves at that point? What's preventing us? I'm trying to save even more money on both ends here. What's preventing us from doing that?
Actually, Madam Chair, Representative Bunn, that came up last night in the Senate. There was a few amendments added late last night. The engrossed version wasn't available today to do an amendment, which we'll probably put on in the next committee, which talks about that. There is a provision that if the advisory committee does see the need, that we could use that mode of transportation, absolutely.
Madam Chair, Representative Bunn, also, if we just leave them, we don't have... we don't feel that we have as good a chance of collecting accurate data, complete data, and we want to have as much information as possible from this entire initiative.
Okay, I'm not seeing any further questions. So, Representative Huntley, do you want to move on to the next piece here?
The next one is Hump Well, it's the A1 amendment, and I'm not going to offer it. This is particularly with Representative Abler sitting right behind me. It's a good idea, but I don't think the time is right now. The attempt is to move people from the Anoka Regional Treatment Center into smaller units in the same area of the city. If you get them down from to 16 beds or less, then medical assistance will pay half of the bill. If they're in a regional treatment center, we pay 100% from the state side. But in addition to Representative Abler, I've heard from some AFSCME people who are a little nervous about this. Mm-hmm. Although the intent would be to have the AFSCME employees still be employed in these smaller facilities. But I'm not going to offer that one today.
Okay. All right, Representative Huntley, thanks for the explanation of the bill not offered. Okay. All right.
Thank you very much.
So, thank you. Okay, I think unless there are other questions, I think we're ready to vote on the bill.
Madam
as unamended.
Representative Bunn and I aren't scared of Representative Abler.
So are you moving? Are you moving
at another point?
Oh, at a okay. So there's no motion before us, huh? Okay. All right. So Representative Huntley renews his motion that House File 1561 be recommended to pass and go to be re-referred to the Transportation and Transit Policy and Oversight Division. All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed, no. The motion is motion prevails and the bill moves on. Thank you. Okay. House File 1646, Representative Huntley.
Again, we have a little switch here. I was going to do an amendment to this bill. And you have the amendment, the A1 amendment to this bill. And I would like to make some minor changes in that A1 amendment. And on line 1.2, strike what is currently there and insert, delete everything after the enacting clause and insert, colon. So basically we're getting rid of the original bill and we're going to substitute this one. And you would also have to make changes on line 2.12, just strike that line. And on line 2.13, change section 3 to section 2. And then you would also delete line 3.6. So that's what is what needs to be done change this, and the description of what's in this amendment then is two things.
One moment, Representative Huntley, before we go to the explanation. I don't think we got the very beginning, but I understand what you're doing here is turning this amendment into a delete all amendment,
right,
correct?
Right.
But we didn't get the very first part of it that you gave us. Could you give us that again?
Yeah, on line 1.2, strike everything there and add, delete everything after the enacting clause and insert, and then colon mark.
Okay. So, let's see if we got this right. On line 1.2, we're deleting the entire line and we're adding, delete everything after the enacting clause and insert, colon. And then the rest of the oral amendment on line 2.12, we're striking that line.
Correct.
Line 2.13, section 3 is becoming section 2. And then on line 3.6, we are striking that line, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Does everybody have that? Okay, so I think we can incorporate those changes, and did we move your, well, did we move your bill?
Well, I would move that 1646 be recommended to pass and sent to the Finance Committee. And then I would move the amendment, the A1 amendment, to that bill.
All right. So I think we actually moved your bill. So Representative Huntley moves the H1646A1 amendment with the changes that were just spoken. So all in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed, no. Okay, the amendment is adopted.
Okay, now, Madam Chair, I will describe the amendment. What this does, and it's an attempt to get some savings again. We don't know yet if it will do that, but it takes people in our public programs and takes their drug coverage out of the managed care and puts it into a fee-for-service system, just the drug part of their medical care. And that would then be run by the state. And again, there are some people that say that will save money, and I think there's a gentleman here who would like to testify that it probably won't. But we will again get fiscal notes, and if it does not save money, I won't be interested in having it in the omnibus bill, I can tell you that.
Okay. Before we get to the other testifiers, we've got a couple testifiers in opposition. Does anybody have questions for Representative Huntley before we go to them? Representative Bunt.
Representative Huntley, can you tell us the mechanism about how one thinks it saves money by doing this?
Representative.
Well, we think we'll pay a lower administrative cost than we're paying the health plans right now for this part of the budget, or this part of the health care delivery that these people get.
Representative Bunn.
And yet their primary providers will still be managing and overseeing the prescribing and keeping track of the records on that. Is this detract in any way from moving towards a healthcare home for this person?
Representative
Bunn. I mean, that's a good question, Representative Bunn and Madam Chair, and that will be discussed. The primary care physician, if it's a primary care physician, would still write the prescription. It's just that the reimbursement to the pharmacy for that prescription would come from the state rather than from the health plan.
Representative Bunn, it sounds to me, it's a little bit familiar to me, this idea. Yeah. It's just changing the payer. Other questions, members? Okay, we have, thank you, Representative Huntley, and we have Mr. Renner, I think, wanted to testify.
We took care of your part.
Madam Chair,
welcome to the committee.
Minister of the Medical Association. My opposition was to the original bill as drafted, and with the newly drafted amended version, we had no longer opposed to that.
All right.
Yeah, Madam Chair, the original bill that we were amending would have required people prescribing psychotropic drugs for children to get a prior authorization first. And after several emails from certain psychiatrists in the cities of Lewis, I decided I didn't want to do that anymore.
We appreciate that.
Right. Well, Representative Huntley, I think I could have pretty much guessed that there would have been opposition from physicians to that idea. So, all right. Thank you. And Jeff Barsh wants to talk. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Barsh. I represent Health Partners. I understand the need to explore a number of different opportunities to try and find savings for our public programs, and we've brought forward a lot of creative ideas as well. We do have a concern with this piece of legislation that goes beyond the dollars and cents. Representative Huntley was correct. We don't believe it will save money, but in addition to that, we do have a question in line with Representative Bunn's question about patient care. Currently, the PMAP members who are with our health plans and others, we do utilize our disease management programs with all of them, and it's very hard to do that when you separate pharmacy claims from medical claims. It gives us a less accurate picture of their experience and the ways in which we can help them improve their overall health. I'm certain that those considerations will be a part of the discussion if there is a fiscal note on this, and if the committee's moving forward would weigh not only a financial impact, but the long-term benefit and health impact to patients as well. I'm happy to answer any questions at this time. Thank you for the opportunity to raise that concern.
Thank you. Questions for members? Okay, I have a quick question, Mr. Barr. Do your members use pharmacy benefit managers to manage this part of the business?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we use a pharmacy benefit manager. I know most health plans do as well. Some have it in-house. The relationship we have with them is the claims do come through us as well. So we have the data from the pharmacy benefit manager to operate our disease management program.
So they're managing the benefit, but then they're just giving you the data after the fact? Did I understand that correctly?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, they help us manage the program. So the payment can come from them, but yes, we work with them and we have the claims data. We do a similar carve-out actually with chiropractic and some other things as well, where we'll have a separate vendor help us manage the program, but the claims information for our members comes to us as well to help manage the overall health of the population.
So there's no reason that claims if the state was doing this, there's no reason that claims information couldn't also come to the plan that was managing the person's care, right?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that is certainly a possibility. In fact, I think the state employees just carved out their drug benefit last year. Mm-hmm. They're working with a vendor in Wisconsin who we've been working with to manage that relationship. It's not necessarily perfect, and I would say our experience in working with the Department of Human Services on transfers and information back and forth would lead us to believe that it would be a struggle, if not an impossibility, to work with them to get accurate data in a timely fashion.
Them fighting words. Representative Abler.
Oh, struggle, huh? Madam Chair, Mr. Barch, or help me, whichever, would this be where they would just walk to the pharmacy and get their meds? Would that be what you read this as? Or would there, like, some of these people are not going to do that very quickly. Is that what this amount anticipates, or Mr. Barth?
Well, I mean, you would get a prescription, Madam Chair and Representative Abler, you would get a prescription from your physician, whoever it was, and he would get, I assume, get paid for the office visit. And then you take that prescription, go to a drugstore, and you give the drugstore a card that says what health plan you have, which in this case would be that bill would go to the state rather than to the pharmacy benefit man.
So Madam, this is my good pharmacist vote for the day, probably, I guess. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative Vapor, until you see the pharmacy reimbursement rate from fee-for-service.
Oh, thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to Representative Huntley or Mr. Barth. You know, one of the things that I thought is sort of interesting and odd is that in the Twin Cities, it's almost gotten to be that Hallmark card shops will have a pharmacy attached to them. I can't believe how they're just popping up in every grocery store and department store, and apparently it's a lively market in the metro area. But in greater Minnesota, I keep hearing that they're having a hard time keeping pharmacies open that people in the area are dependent upon, and I'm wondering if they're... You know, how would that contribute to that potential problem in greater Minnesota of not having adequate access to a local pharmacy?
Well,
Representative Huntley.
Madam Chair, and it seems to me that the state would contract with all these pharmacies the same way most benefit manufacturers, pharmacy benefit managers do. And so you just take your card and you go to the pharmacy. I mean, when I, in the city of Duluth, when I have my choice of virtually any pharmacy in the city.
Madam Chair, just to follow up on that, well, it seems to me that many insurance plans now require you to get most of your medications or strongly incent you to get most of your medications by mail, which may not be from even anyone in Minnesota. And so that was my concern about whether or not this would actually help the local storefront pharmacy stay open.
because I suspect it's cheaper if you go with the bigger vendors. I'm not sure.
Okay, Representative Bunn. And then we'll take a vote.
Thank you. Mr. Bartz, you just hit on something a moment ago about in your comment, offhand comment to Representative Abler about the fee-for-service pharmacy payments. I think this issue may parallel our dental carve-out discussion we may have here in the future sometime, which is, are you saying to us that the TMAP pharmacy rates currently are higher than we get for the fee-for-service rates under this program if we carve this out? And hence, we may actually be detrimentally affecting our local pharmacists, not helping them tonight. Representative Edwards.
Mr. Barsh. Madam Chair and Representative Bunn, not knowing the actual difference in reimbursement fee-for-service versus PMAP, I don't know. That's a bad attempt at humor. But I would agree that if there is a differential, that would be a concern in terms of access.
Okay, if there are no further questions, Representative Huntley renews his motion that House File 1646, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, no.
No.
The motion prevails.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair, and there is.
All right, House File 884. House File 884. Representative Thiessen moves that House File 884 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations.
And I do have an oral amendment, Madam Chair, on line 1.9.
Okay, hold on one second, if you would, Representative Thiessen.
Sure.
Okay, go ahead.
1.9, delete finance and insert administration.
Okay, is that it?
Yeah.
Okay, so do you want to just, I think we could just incorporate that change, can't we?
I think we got to move it.
You're going to move it as an oral amendment? Okay. All right, does everybody have the amendment on line 1.9? Strike the word finance and insert the word administration. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Okay, the motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This legislation basically is designed to create a bulk purchasing pool for medical equipment for a, you can see the list of purchasers, the groups that would be involved there. So government units, the things that the state operates, correctional facilities, state-operated facilities, public health facilities, and then some health care facilities that the state doesn't operate but fund, basically like nursing homes and other hospitals and community clinics. And it's kind of building on our pharmaceutical bulk purchasing tools that we're already using. And the idea, again, is to see if we can actually generate some savings either to the state or to these providers to help them weather these tough economic times. And I don't know if anybody's listed as a testifier, but I know the Department of Administration is here, and I think it'd be worthwhile hearing from them about the bill.
Okay.
Because they've raised some concerns, so I'd like to hear what they are exactly again.
Welcome to the committee.
Thanks. My name is Kent Allen. I'm the Director of the Materials Management Division in the Department of Administration. Actually, we think it makes sense to change the responsible agency here from the Department of Finance, which doesn't do purchasing and doesn't operate the current pharmaceutical program, to the Department of Administration, which does. And we believe we can do something similar to what's described in the bill here, although we do have some problems with definitions and scope, and let me comment on those briefly. In discussion with our lawyers, we are strongly advised that we need to be very mindful of the potential of violating antitrust laws, federal and state, if we're purchasing for a broader pool of potential customers for this program than we service in our pharmaceutical program. The pharmaceutical program covers state-operated facilities, doesn't provide pharmaceutical or related services for any private or for-profit facilities. And as we've discussed this bill and looked at the definition of purchaser, it has come to our attention that this would go beyond that group of government-run facilities that we believe were allowed to do purchasing on behalf of. Another perhaps more minor problem with the bill is the fact that it's creating a sort of a separate program. We believe we have the authority under the existing program to buy medical supplies and equipment, and actually had intended to try to move more aggressively into that area in the upcoming fiscal year. As we've talked to customers of the current program, heard from consultants with respect to the opportunities that might be there that the state hasn't pursued, we've been strongly encouraged to move into the area of medical supplies and equipment, and believe we can do that with the current program. The way the bill is drafted, we think there would be issues with respect to fiscal startup costs and so forth that actually wouldn't be there if we just relied on our current authority and the current program to move in the direction of more medical supplies and equipment for the groups that we can provide services to. So we support the concept. Some of the details as to how it's laid out in the bill are problematic for us.
Okay, thank you. Representative Thiessen, did you want to respond at all? Or?
Madam Chair, I we have had this discussion before, and that's why I wanted Mr. Allen to come up. I think I think that there's an idea here that we need to kind of look at and pursue. I think it's probably correct. I want to get more information on what the scope of it can be, because obviously we get a little bit more traction the broader the scope could be. And so we need to look at this antitrust issue. In addition, we may be able to refine this. This is language coming again over from the Senate. We may be able to refine this legislation just to build up the current program. And I think it kind of depends on how far we can expand the scope of the current purchasers of the Drug Purchasing Alliance. If we can expand beyond that, it may be worth exploring that further. So I think, you know, what I would suggest to the committee is that I think there's a policy issue. There's two policy issues before us. One is whether we think it makes sense to do bulk purchasing for medical supplies and not just limit ourselves to pharmaceuticals. And secondly, whether it makes sense, setting aside the antitrust issue, of whether it makes sense to expand beyond just kind of state-operated facilities and try to, if we can, create a bulk purchasing pool beyond that. And then, you know, with that kind of guidance, perhaps we can work on how best to accomplish that end. But this, you know, quite clearly, these discussions just kind of arose in the last day. And so I understand that this isn't a finished piece, but it will go to GovOps and other places.
Okay, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to Representative Thiessen and Mr. Allen. I hope as you're exploring this, you'll also look into the concept of potentially having reuse of Medicaid-provided equipment. If that's not appropriate for everything, but for things like a Hoyer lift, for an electronic wheelchair. There's a lot of things that I think aren't customized specifically to the person that, quite honestly, oftentimes are provided in as a short-term rehab sort of situation, or maybe very short-term use before someone passes away. And it seems like we might want to look at that and figure out a way that we can transfer them to, for example, like a Hoyer lift. If you have a group home that needs that for a particular person and that person no longer needs that, that should be transferred to another facility that could, as opposed to buying new. And I'm sure there's some liability issues with some pieces of it, but I think we ought to look at that for when it's appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Representative Abler. Or unless it's to that point, Representative Emery. Representative Abler.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Peterson, if it happens to just take Senate language, you just get in trouble, because our work is so much better here than customarily. So just the, you know, the freshmen can learn, you know, from your peril that you're at here. Just one question I have, or thoughts. And I think that it's good to work on this tonight. A lot of things are work in progress, and we'll need more good ideas like this to get out of this session. I think just to be aware that we don't hurt some of the small vendors that are actually providing good service as well as cost in the, some of the hinterland places, in particular when you get in the outskates, the hardware store, which has been productive. And I don't know, I mean, it's voluntary, but I think there was some move on a certain governor's part to make some of this purchasing. The counties have to join, the school districts have to join into these mandatory things, and so just to be aware you don't hurt some of the local people. And maybe the, I don't know, I'll leave it at that.
All right. Thank you. Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Thiessen, there are a couple other problems that you may want to look at if you keep moving forward. One, I mean, there's a lot, but these stick out. Like, Commissioner may charge manufacturers and sellers a fee, but it doesn't restrict it. I mean, you get to charge a fee, whatever that fee might be, whether you actually reach a negotiated price or not. That's not clear. It's also not clear that you're getting a discount no matter what you do. And then you go under Subdivision 5, where you say that you've got to make the negotiated contract price available to all purchasers. Well, I mean, volume is what generates the discount or the lower price. And I think, plus you do have the antitrust problem, I think, based on a similar proposal that's floating around with respect to county. The idea of pooling resources or volume purchasing is a good one, but I don't know that the state has to be, even though it's a state program, I don't know that it has to have all these little additional, you know, fees. I think you're going to run into other problems, but the concept of purchasing in volume is a good one.
All right. Okay. Any closing comments, Representative Thiessen?
No, Madam Chair. This is helpful guidance. I don't know if people had any insight on expanding it beyond the government to other facilities, but I don't want to take up any more time either. People need to talk to me in person. How about that, if they do? So this is, anyway, if you guys want to pass it, I think it's worth exploring. I know it's not ready to be passed, really, but we can get to we can get to the next committee, and it'll be coming back to finance, but so that's all I have to say about it.
All right.
I think there's a kernel of a good idea here. Work in progress.
Okay, well, Representative Thiessen moves that House file.
Strongly moves.
Strongly moved. Okay. House File 884, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails, and we are adjourned.